I mean, I can withdraw it right now.
Yeah.
Okay, which item? Which one?
Yeah, so that motion.
And so the two engagement tasks.
Okay,
sounds good.
Thank you.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I am going to call this meeting to order. Thank you very much for coming. As always, we'll call this meeting to order at 6:04 p.m. As always, we'll begin with attendance. President Kuzma is here. He's just waiting outside for our guests. Vice President Schellen. Vice President Woods.
Here.
Vice President Lay.
Present.
Vice President Lau.
Present.
Governor Kelly. I think you're here. Governor Kelly. Is this sound working again? I think he's saying on... Yeah, okay. Thank you. Councillor Battelle.
Present.
Councillor Borden.
Present.
Councillor Mills, I believe, also present. Councillor Mills, could you text in if you're... Or type in if you're here? Well, if you say present later, I'll just mark you as present. Councillor Hanwell.
Present.
Councillor Bannister.
Present.
Councillor Schiavone. Councillor Schiavone? No. Councillor Mohammed?
Present.
Councillor Grulke?
Present.
Councillor Minarski?
Present.
Councillor Valdez? Councillor Corbett? Councillor Redman?
Present.
Councillor Hamid? Councillor Morris? Councillor Nguyen?
Here.
Councillor Champagne, I believe, is here. Councillor Champagne, are you around? Give me a... Okay, thank you. Councillor Speakman.
Here.
Councillor Hodgson. Councillor Huang.
Present.
Councillor Zhang.
Present.
Councillor Grehan.
Present.
Councillor Binchik.
Present.
Councillor Douglas. Councillor Douglas. No. Mr. Dumichel. Okay, Vice President Schellen. Okay, a motion to suspend standing orders. I'm assuming, because we spoke about this earlier. Yeah, if you want to explain.
I'd like to suspend standing orders to both allow non-councillor speaking privileges, as well as to extend the first presentation to a total of 1 hour.
Okay, and you're saying extend speaking privileges to guests for item 2A's presentation. Okay, so for clarity on everyone there, so there would be suspension of two rules there, both relating to item 2A, so to allow non-members of council to have speaking privileges during that presentation, and also to extend that presentation to a total of 1 hour. Do we have a seconder for that motion? Councillor Grehan, thank you very much. That's non-debatable, non-amendable, requires two-thirds majority vote. Vice President Schellen, would you care to introduce?
Yeah, I'd like to give our speakers more time to present, and I would love to also allow other students who are in counselors to ask questions.
Okay, so again, all those in favor of suspending the rules? Any opposed? Okay, that motion's carried, so those rules are suspended. Just a couple of other speakers' business announcements. So, again, if you are a guest and you intend on speaking on that, I have a guest list up here. So just at some point, preferably beforehand, if you are planning on asking a question, just come sign, write your name and sign your name on the part here that says Guest of Students Council, excuse me. So we'll make sure to have you on there. I believe that is all I have for updates. Are our presenters ready? Excellent. So we'll just take a couple minutes to get set up for the presentation. Yes. Just want to, sorry, drop over here and just
write sign your name.
Hi. It's just two slides. I wouldn't call the presentation.
No problem. I can pop it in here.
All right, thanks. And it's got most of my research data on it, so you probably know that. Oh, I can do it all. And it's just that way. So.
Okay. Which file it is here.
Do I need to find it?
It's just, this is... Oh, sorry. I noticed my own hiding down here.
We don't need to run this. We don't need to sort of pop it up there until we get to the question. I'll minimize it now.
Okay.
And then we can pull it up with a signal getting out. There it is.
Yeah. Perfect. Yeah, great. Okay, good. We can still see. We've got a couple people on Skype, and then I can see if they have a question as well.
So I'm not sure if you have any sort of presentation beforehand.
Just a few for questions.
I want to make the most.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, so I guess we'll get started. Dr. Ferguson Powell will perhaps do a quick introduction, and then we'll jump right into Q&A, which I can, of course, moderate.
Great, thank you very much. So thanks very much for the opportunity to come, and I can see from your questions that you sent, which I really appreciate getting in advance because it allows me to do a little bit of research. I can't promise all the numbers are precise, but the intent at least behind them is to get the most accurate picture for you as possible. But I can see from your questions that a lot of it is focused on budget-related things, which is quite understandable. As you mostly know, I'm sure, we've been through since March 7th an unparalleled situation in terms of the budget challenges we have in the cuts that we started to put in place. We had to move very quickly in terms of getting our CIP, our Comprehensive Institutional Plan, into the government in a timely manner and still taking it through our governance process for the second time. And we needed to start to draw up the impact of the 13-14 budget on the faculties and administration in a very short time frame. So that is now done. We, as you know, sent letters to the deans outlining the, in broad terms, the budget cuts that we felt would be the best way for the institution to handle the first year of the budget cuts, which is $26 million. And then what we've been focusing on in the last 6 weeks or so is the budget going forward. And that is to get us to a balanced position where we remove another $56 million out of the academy in order to get to the balanced position that is necessary for us to be sustainable. So this, as you can imagine, was not anticipated, has taken a great deal of our resources away from some of the other things we'd very much like to be doing. What I wanted to tell you was that although it may have seemed that we may not have been able to interact with you as closely as we would have liked to during that immediate period after March 7th, what we would like to do is to keep you informed as we go forward with the 14, 15, 15, 16 budget years. So however, you do need to understand time frames on this, and the critical time frame we're dealing with is that the way that the budget process works normally is that by the time you get to the sort of middle of fall, so somewhere around about the third week of October, the ministries start to talk to Treasury about what the budget allocations are going to be to the various ministries for the upcoming financial year. So the case we need to make for the U of A needs to be in front of the ministries by the time we get to second, third week of October in order to be sure that they hear the messages about the things we intend to do, the issues that we may be challenged by, and to try and advocate for more dollars that will flow into our ministry and therefore into our university for the next year. So even though it may seem like only the other day that we put the 13-14 budget to bed, actually we are rushing now to start to work out what we're going to do with the 14-15 budget, and therefore our consultation process is going to be short and sweet in order to meet those timelines. So I just wanted to emphasize the critical time frames that we have to work with in order to be able to meet these deadlines and position the university as strongly as possible. That, therefore, we're looking from all of our stakeholders, the SU, GSA, ASHUA, NASA in particular, the maximum level of agility that we can achieve in order to get the discussion going, the ideas flowing, but at the same time some decisive decisions being made so that we can get to that balanced position. So that's the budget situation. I think I should leave it there, and let's get started with questions. And then if I feel at the end of the day we're sort of repeating ourselves and we still have scope for other things to talk about, then maybe I could initiate some other discussions as well that would broaden things out. Because I am worried that, given the situation we find ourselves in, that the university becomes so focused on budget that we forget some of the other things that are critically important about us moving forward, the transformation of the U of A, a research-intensive university, in the global context. We must remember that U of A sees itself, it is, one of the top five universities in Canada. It needs to be there, if not better, and it needs to be highly competitive in the international arena. And so local issues about our budget are not things that people in India or China or the UK or US necessarily particularly care about. What they're interested in is outcomes. And so what we really need to look at is how can we produce the best possible outcomes for the U of A. And hearing from you about what your expectations of those outcomes should be is really important as well. So if we can preserve a little time to talk about those things, I would really appreciate it, because it would be a nice break from the budget discussion. And it does talk about what's really important to us. The U of A is not defined just by Campus Alberta. It's defined by the U15, which is the top 15 research-intensive universities in Canada. It's defined by the top 5, which we're a member of, and is defined by our international competition, which is what we've been working towards. So I'll stop there, leave it in your hands, and do my very best to answer your questions.
Okay, thank you. So as always, I'll just take questions by raising your placard, and I'll add you to the list. I'll note you when you do, because we'll probably have a few questions. Just make sure you're asking only one question at a time. Throw your placard back up. I'll add you to the bottom of the list again so that we can try and get as many different faces in. If you're a member of council, just throw your placard up. If you're a guest, just throw your hand up, and I'll signal one. I'm just going to sneak around and grab this so that I can write my notes down. And I would also encourage you, just so Dr. Ferguson-Pell has more time to answer your questions, that you try and make your questions as succinct as possible so we can utilize the time as best as possible. So I'll open the floor to questions. Councillor Hodgson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you for giving your time tonight to come and talk with us. I was just curious, so where are, is the university currently in the budget process for the 2013-2014 year? So it's been submitted to the ministry currently, and just wondering where are we right now?
So what I should do is clarify this a little bit, because there is the comprehensive institutional plan, which really defines what our goals and direction are for the 13-14 and beyond period. And that talks about very broad issues, not just the budget. It talks about our research enterprise, it talks about advancement, it talks about communications and our relationship with the community, it talks about innovation and advancement in education, our pedagogies, and so on. So very broad issues are contained within the CIP. And within the CIP is the budget. And so what we did in the CIP budget section was we put forward a three-year budget. So the level of detail for the 2 years after the current year is really very broad, in that there is very little detail in there, because we didn't want to preempt the discussions that we wanted to have across the academy. But the 13-14 budget, the one with the year we're in right now, up until April 1st, 2014, is one that we had to hustle with and get done quickly in order to be able to move the academy forward, because clearly the budget announcement came out on March 7th. We had to put in a budget with a massive cutback in it in order to be ready and up and running for April 1st. So
The CIP was submitted to the government, is currently being reviewed. We have had a meeting, which we had last week, with the Assistant Deputy Minister and his team to talk about our CIP. Some of the feedback we've received has been, I think, very positive, in the sense that the Deputy Minister said to us that he had lost count of the number of times we had referred to Campus Alberta in our document and was very impressed by that, and that it was interesting to note that that part of the CIP was written before March 7th. So this was the status quo, as far as we were concerned, in terms of the level of activity that we had going on across Campus Alberta and our level of commitment to it. So I think that was something that they registered and highlighted. In terms of the current budget, that is still something that is being discussed. So we haven't got closure on the CIP. We haven't got closure on our budget proposal. And as I think you probably remember, the basic, and this I'm doing from memory, but the basic situation is that the deficit for the current year, 13-14, would be about $40 million, that we would be looking for taking about $28 million out next year, and then we'd be talking about close to $30 million the following year. A lot of this depends upon how quickly you do things, in that if you can accelerate that process, then you can save some money. But if you over-accelerate the process, it can cost you money. So what do I mean by that? So let me give you an example. If we over-accelerate the process, it means that opportunities for generating revenue and bringing about cost savings that don't impact directly on layoffs may be lost. So if you're forced to do more layoffs than you absolutely have to do within your time frame, then what it costs you is the layoff money, which is cash. So the simple rule is that, is the following. For every $100,000 worth of salary, you have to pay approximately $100,000 worth of one-time layoff money as well. So in a given year, it's actually double the cost of the salary. And then you've, of course, got benefits and pension and other things to take into account as well. So the cash cost of an overly accelerated budget process is not wise management of your resources. On the other hand, an overly slow and cautious process is one that has numerous effects. It has effects in terms of ongoing compounding costs that occur within any budget. And then secondly, it has a phenomenal impact on morale. And part of that impact on morale is you start to lose people you most value. Some of the people who may be in the strongest position to look for, or maybe even highly sought after by other institutions. And so people that you've just invested over the last 5 to 10 years in significant amounts of money to bring them to Alberta, to set up their lab, to give them a startup program, to support their students in terms of graduate students and so on, suddenly that all blows up. And those resources that you've just invested are lost because that person goes somewhere else. So an overly accelerated process and an under-accelerated process both have adverse effects. So what you're looking for is trying to find that sweet spot where you can achieve the goal that has to be achieved, unfortunately, but do so with the minimum amount of damage to the institution, and also look at other possibilities that might arise in terms of mitigating income that you could use to reduce the impact. So that's the sort of approach that we've been trying to adopt. Very quickly, I would say that one of the concerns people have raised with us is, why does it seem to be taking so long, or why is there so little information coming out, or why isn't it we haven't been as quick and as assertive as some other institutions in Campus Alberta? Well, I hope you understand some of the reasons were the ones I just gave. That the scale at the U of A is very high, and that the complexity is very high, and that what we've been trying to do is do it in a way to preserve resources as much as possible, to keep ourselves strong.
Thank you. Councilor Mohammed?
Thank you. So in April, the Deputy Premier stated that tuition will be raised, yet the international differential fee is being increased by 2.15% to offset the loss of the tuition freeze. So my question to you is, will international students be facing a tuition hike? And if so, how is this justified based on the minister's promise in April?
So the increase in the international differential fee is a fee that we are enabled to increase, and we're increasing it based on the cost of living increase of 2.5%. And so the latitude that we had on the international differential fee was one that isn't compensated through other mechanisms. It's not compensated through the government. So all we were doing was really keeping that fee indexed against the prevailing index for tuition increase. So there was an increase this year in the tuition cost, but it was paid for by a one-time payment by the government for the domestic students. And so there is not a government-funded component for the international differential fee. So what we were doing was recovering that that component that relates to the international differential fee based on the cost of living increase. Does that answer your question satisfactorily?
Councillor Patel?
Yes.
You mentioned that it was submitted before the budget came out. So I'm wondering how, I mean, it feels like we haven't gone back to review that CIP. And I feel it's kind of like buying a house that you can't afford. So if we can't afford to achieve all of these goals, given that we're going to a deficit, why is it that being reviewed and why are we putting more pressure on the institution to achieve those goals?
So that's a good point. So a couple of points of clarification. First of all, the CIP itself was not actually delivered to government before the budget. What had happened was the CIP went through our governance process. And so that gave ample opportunity for various stakeholders to guide the content of that. Now, I would say that the and one of the authors of the CIP is Dr. Skidmore, that there is a lot of aspirational information that's provided in the CIP. It's where we want to go, what we value in terms of our priorities. It is the intent of the institution. It is not a line-by-line budget, if you like, or a line-by-line set of specific things that we're going to do. So there is some latitude in terms of interpretation and some latitude in terms of stretching out time. And so even though the budget came in as far under as it did, it was necessary to meet all of those goals. Our feeling was that that despite that, the University of Alberta should not suddenly lower its expectations of itself as a result of those budget cuts. That, I think, would be a very short-sighted thing to do, because I think the first thing you would want to do under those kinds of circumstances is to say, well, to what extent can I compensate? To what extent can I maintain those goals but achieve efficiencies or changes in ways of doing things to enable us to meet those goals, but to do that with the reduced budget? And if I can't do that in the originally intended time frame, can I still do it if I stretch the time frame out? So that was the way we looked at it. We did not want, and maybe you know this was excessive optimism on behalf of the university, but we did not want to suddenly lower the aspirations of the university as a result of this one-time budget cut. And I think you have to know the history that precedes this. So if you look back to when our president came to the U of A, she set very high expectations of what the U of A would be trying to accomplish during the term of her presidency. 2 terms, 10 years, right? And her goal was to transform the U of A and bring the U of A into a new sphere of excellence to be even more competitive in relation to our peers in Canada and internationally, and to position the university as a place that is strong and a place where people wanted to come and get their undergraduate and graduate degrees, and they would beat a path to our door. That's what she set out to do. And that people would respect the university for being a leader in publicly funded universities in North America. So here you are, 8 years into that period, having accomplished a huge amount, and suddenly this one event occurs. If that happens, should you suddenly change your aspirations, dumb down the institution, wash it all away, and just say, well, you know, here we are, that's too bad? No. What you do is you fight. You fight for the things that you think are worthwhile. And you go out there and become creative and imaginative and entrepreneurial in order to find ways to keep true to your goal. And so that's what we've been trying to do.
Councillor Hanlon?
Thank you for the presentation. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So I'm just wondering, a lot of some administration have said, you know, we're trying to make the budget as open as possible, and we definitely appreciate that. So I'm wondering, in regards to trying to fix these cuts, will you guys be looking at salaries of administration or the faculty at all?
Yes, this is certainly something we would look at. Now, first of all, remember the way this all works, right? So you're members of an association or a union, right? So this is a collective body that works on behalf of its membership. Well, the university has a similar mechanism for academic staff. That's ASHWA. And it has a similar mechanism, an association for its non-academic staff, which is NASA. So, interestingly, ASHWA, which looks after the academic staff, is the membership association for all academic members of the university, including the president, including the provost and others. So everybody essentially is a member of that association. And as you know, in order to function effectively, you need to function as a collective. You need to work together, and you need to have an agreed set of directions and priorities and positions on things. And of course, in this case of an association such as ASHWA, this also represents the focus of our collective agreement, which defines the terms of employment, including compensation. And so we had a contract in place with ASHWA, an agreement, collective agreement, for 2 years that was effective this year and next year. And at the time that we negotiated the salaries under that agreement, we were considered to be the pacemakers for the academic institutions in the province, but coming in with a very modest salary increase of 1.65% for the first year and 1.65% for the second year of the agreement. Of course, subsequently, the teachers' union negotiations set a new standard of 0002, which you've probably heard about, and then similarly, the doctors came in with a 0002. So here we were now with an agreement in place, an agreement underway, and then the landscape changed to 0002, and so 1.65 suddenly seemed to be a little bit higher than what other people were doing. But at the time we came to that agreement, and we did that collectively, we were pacemakers in terms of coming in with a very modest increase for salaries within the university. So those collective agreement rules work right across the academy, right up to the president. And so that's the way we function. And I think that what we can do, we can talk more about salaries, I'm happy to do that, it certainly is one of the things that we need to look at going forward. The fact that we came in with a modest salary increase during our negotiations about 18 months ago is indicative of the fact that we saw that containing salaries was important in order to preserve the economic strength of the university going forward. So 18 months ago, we recognized this as something that we wanted to focus on. But this was not central administration alone doing that, but central administration doing that jointly with partners in ASHWA.
Additional questions? You're Raman, right?
Yes.
Mr. Raman, yes.
Thank you again for coming, Dr.
Pleasure.
I was just wondering what would happen if, say, we were looking at closing programs. I wonder what metrics would be used to evaluate the program quality.
Yeah.
Make a decision as we.
It's a very interesting question, and I think that, first of all, closing programs is not something that happens spontaneously. It's a very consultative process. It's laid down in an article of the collective agreement called Article 32. And if you wanted to read Article 32, which I suggest you do close to time to go to bed, it will definitely put you to sleep. It's a very, very complex process. But what it does is it does define the terms that are necessary to close programs, especially if those programs result in academic layoffs. So you asked about criteria. So we had a board retreat that was intended to look at the direction of the university, not in the short term, not in terms of the 13-14 budget year. It was something that had been planned a year ahead of time. but was intended to look at the long-term direction of the university. And at that board retreat, one of the things we established, and Petros was there, was to establish some budget principles. And the budget principles were some points of reference so that as we went through this difficult period, including program closures and changes, then we would have something to make sure we were on a set of principles that were mutually agreed upon at board level. So I think you've had an opportunity to see what those principles are, but the emphasis of them is pretty simply stated in terms of the important thing is to preserve excellence. Now, excellence is a very strange word because we use it very widely in the university environment, but it encompasses quite a lot of different things. Excellence, of course, is a comparator, so it's how we stand compared to our peers. So I think one of the things we want to look at when we start thinking about whether or not we would close a program would be how does this program compare against its peers elsewhere in the country? Is it excellent? I think another thing we need to look at is it duplicative? Is this similar program or even a better program being offered somewhere else that would be accessible to our Burton students? So that's another factor we would need to look at. Is it using resources wisely? So there are programs that can be very costly. They can be very costly because they're very important or they're very complex to deliver. Or it may be very costly because for some reason or other it has embedded inefficiencies in it. So we would be looking at the cost effectiveness of some programs as one of the factors that we would look at, but it would not be used in isolation. So that gives you a taste of some of the things that we'd be looking at. So the decisions, where these decisions are made is very important to understand. In that there may be a sense that somehow or other in central administration, the provost and the provost dean somehow are weaving away down in the basement, figuring out which programs to keep alive and which ones to close. That's not actually the way it works. Programs are managed by the deans of the faculties. And the deans of the faculties have faculty councils, they have faculty executives, and this process of making decisions within faculties is actually where these program changes are most likely to be initiated. And there is good student representation on those faculty councils. And in order for any of those program changes to occur, the first step in the Article 32 process is for consultation with the faculty council. So I'd recommend close engagement as students with your faculty councils to make sure that you have a say and you understand why and what priorities are being set so that you can help to set the right path for program changes right from the very beginnings of the whole process. However, if that escapes you or if you feel you need to intervene in terms of programs outside of your faculty, then the process goes on. And so it goes through APC, goes through various other bodies, subcommittees are established where all of these things are discussed. So program changes in the U of A system are not done quickly, and they need consultation right across the academy, through GFC, and eventually have to be approved by the government. So many, many opportunities for you to have a say as they start to roll out. But I hope I've given you an indication as to what kind of measures we'd be using, you know, from our standpoint to advise deans and to guide them in terms of what things to look for.
Councillor Hodgson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So I'm kind of curious how, why do you think the university never saw this coming? Like, where was the breakdown in communication with government on what was expected? Because I know, at least hearing earlier in the year, that a 2% increase was predicted, and I know the university did budget for different situations, but it was unprecedented, basically, the cut. So where was the breakdown in communication? And what has the university been talking about what can be done in the future to prevent something like this happening?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question. We ask ourselves this, you know, to what extent could we have seen this coming? And I did attend a meeting that the Premier came to and was the occasion when she talked about the bitumen bubble. And in the room at the time were 26 presidents across the PSEs plus the board chairs. And we all heard her give that presentation. And many of us came away from that thinking, well, there goes the 2%. But we were thinking, there goes 2% down to zero, or maybe slightly under zero. That was not just the U of A's impression, but that was the impression right across the board. And there were a lot of university leaders right across the province after that date. And I believe that was in February, may have been late January. Many people at that time thought that times were tough, they could see it in the economy, but the scale that they were anticipating was of the order of not plus two, but maybe as bad as plus two minus one, so a difference of three. That was the kind of number that we were working with. But right up until the very moment of the announcement, and I remember vividly these occasions where on the 6th of March there was a phone conference where the Deputy Premier called in and we were anticipating getting at least a 24 hours heads up, and even at that phone call at that 11th hour, no information was imparted to us in terms of what would happen. So the size of the cut was known to all of university leadership right across the PSE at the very moment everybody else found out. Now, the other thing to bear in mind is that we had a change of minister in the middle of all of this, in that during February, Minister Khan stood down and Minister Lukasik took over. And so it's very difficult to know whether or not that contributed to any aspect of the communication issues that you're referring to. Maybe if we'd had time to build a relationship prior to the announcement, there might have been a better mutual understanding of where we're going. But I think these were the circumstances. From my standpoint, I don't think there is any sense that we were asleep at the wheel. I just think these were surprising circumstances, unusual times, and, you know, 50-odd leaders of post-secondary institutions were all surprised by it.
Mr. Novak, right?
Yeah. Hi, my name is Chris Novak from the Student Association.
Yeah.
As recently as this afternoon at Faculty Council, Dean of Medicine and Dr. Douglas Miller has talked about market modifiers to increase revenue for faculty medicine. I was just wondering if you have any comments on these fees and their impact on students.
Right. Well, regarding market modifiers, you probably know we have a committee called TBAC and MBAC, right? And this is an environment in which we talk about market modifiers. So, at the moment, we have no specific plans in relation to market modifiers. We can certainly see one or two situations where, in professional programs, there may be opportunities for an increase in order to bring the tuition in those programs up to the market level. Probably the most obvious one is in the Faculty of Law. And the Faculty of Law's tuition is significantly trailing the levels elsewhere in Canada, certainly for schools of our caliber. And so we believe that a market-based approach is a reasonable approach to doing this. We hear anecdotally that having tuition levels in professional programs that are significantly lower than the market rate raises questions, especially in international students, but not exclusively, about the quality of the program. If it's so cheap, what's wrong with it? We hear that frequently. Now, that's not a reason to raise it, but it gives you a sense as to the perception that people can have when our tuition lags behind so far other programs elsewhere in Canada. And we're using Canada as the comparator, not international tuition, such as you would find in the US or the UK or whatever. So where we stand right now is TBAC and MBAC will have further discussions about market modifiers going forward. We don't know what the position of the government is going to be in the 14-15 financial year in accepting a budget that includes a proposal for market modifiers. Most of the indicators right now are that the government is quite cautious around the whole tuition question. But we would like to have a conversation with you about this because those tuition represents a significant part of the income of the university. If that income doesn't come in, then we have to cut it out. That means we're taking resources out of the institution to compensate for a shortfall in potential revenue. And that's a discussion, that's a tension that exists in managing any organization. It's even if you were running a candy store. you've still got to judge what price you're going to put on the candy in order to maximize the net revenue that you're going to have in order to optimize that company, that organization. We face the same issues, that we need to try and get that balance right, and if we can't bring in the revenue on the tuition side, then we're going to have to take that out of the expenditure side. That's going to mean fewer professors, fewer resources, fewer supplies and materials for labs, and so on. And that's the hard reality of it.
Councillor Schiavone?
Schiavone?
Yeah. My apologies. I'm having a brain fart. This is embarrassing. Narski, thank you.
I guess just following up on the comments you just made, what is it UofA doing to look for new revenue sources that aren't tuition?
Yeah. Good question. So there are a number of things that we're looking at. I think there are many others, but I think we've just started to work on it. So let me give you one of the most obvious and one of the things I think we can move quickly. So revenue isn't always something you can just turn on and off like a faucet. And so sometimes it takes 3 or 4 years to build up a mechanism that will generate sufficient net revenue to be of significance. But there's one area in particular that we're looking at, and that is around the indirect costs associated with contract research. So there are at least two types of research that we do. Some of it is tri-council funded. So that comes from the federal government. There are some indirect costs that we receive to support the cost of performing that research at the U of A. It represents, I think, around about 25% of the direct cost budget of that particular research grant that a professor brings in. The more successful our professors are at bringing in those research grants, then the more indirect cost funding we get, and the more we can plow that into the academy. So having outstandingly good professors who have sufficient time to be able to do research, who are internationally competitive, brings in federal dollars. So take Johns Hopkins University, for example, in Baltimore, Maryland, not exactly one of the most beautiful places on the planet. Anyone from Baltimore? Okay. It's okay, then. But Johns Hopkins is a world-class university. It brings in somewhere in the region of $1.5 billion a year of federal money in research grants. Think that what that does to their economy. Think what that does at 25%. In fact, the rate in the United States for indirect costs is 40%. And think what that does to the economy of their university through the success of their professors. However, the competitiveness of tri-council funding is of the order of around about 12 to 15% of grant proposals submitted are successful. So even good professors are putting in significant amounts of time in order to be successful in securing just one grant. So that's one part of the picture, that we successful with tri-council funding, we bring in indirect costs. So what we can do to boost the research enterprise will boost our ability to bring in those federal dollars, direct and indirect. The other aspect of it is that there are numerous organizations and companies around the province and beyond that need our expertise in order to function. The government does. Companies that are active within the province and across Canada need academic expertise to be successful and competitive. They write contracts with the university in order to perform particular discrete pieces of work that enable them to move their work forward. So that's a commercially oriented contract. The indirect costs on a commercial contract like that are currently 20%. We collect 3%. And so we have a shortfall in the amount of indirect funding that we should be bringing in of about 17%. And this is because there is a reluctance in the conversations that are held between professors and the companies to ask for the indirect cost. The concern is that somehow or other that could impair the competitiveness of the proposal, that somehow or other they would take the money out of the direct costs and make the project less viable. So there is a reluctance. And while we have allowed that flexibility, we have suffered from a significant shortfall in revenue. So what we are now doing is tightening up the procedures. We're improving the skills of our professors in negotiating those indirect costs. And we're essentially making mandatory going forward that people will bring in that 20% indirect cost. that is funding that then comes into the bottom line of the university. It's shared in various proportions between central administration, the faculty, the department, and the professor to enable them to use those funds to move forward their various different activities. So that's one example where a significant improvement can be brought about by that procedural change around those costs. Another example, this takes a little bit longer, is there is a significant demand out there for selected course-based master's degrees. So the classic example of that is an MBA. We all know about the MBA. And however, increasingly, there are opportunities for people who are maybe in the middle stages of their career, who want to enhance their skills, to be more competitive, move up a level, if you like, in the organization they work for, who want to do additional training at the master's level in very specifically defined areas of specialist expertise, and to do a course-based master's to do that. And the funding that we can attract through those direct payments that are made by those individuals and their employers would enable us to fund with a net revenue new programs that would be course-based, master's-based. So that's another example of the sort of thing that we can do. There are others, but these are the sorts of things that we're wanting to drive forward. And I don't want to overly state what this can represent as a proportion of 56 million, but I'm thinking it's reasonable to assume that we could certainly secure a few million a year that will take some of the edge off that 56 million in the short term through those additional revenues.
Councillor Vittel?
You mentioned earlier that this is a one-time cut, and I'm wondering, like, how can you tell that it's a one-time cut? I mean, you didn't see it coming in the first place, so why do you think this is just a one-time thing?
So if I said that, I didn't really mean it. I didn't mean it was a one-time cut. It was certainly an unusual cut. It's a, well, what do they call floods? A once-in-a-100-years flood, right? I'm hoping this is a once-in-a-100-years cut. So that's really what I meant. It's that sort of a very substantial reduction in our overall Campus Alberta grant. So no, I have no reason to believe that this is a one-time cut, and I have no evidence to suggest that we wouldn't experience further cuts even in the relatively near future. I have no information about that. I just don't know. And so what do you do? What sort of preparations for the worst are appropriate without you overcompensating? And so I think that our view at the moment is that we're going to work on the basis that we see zero in the next coming year, and that we're going to budget on that basis. If we can see a little bit more than zero, then that will give us a little bit more flexibility. We're obviously advocating as hard as we can with the government to try and correct the situation through various mechanisms. There are sometimes one-time sources of funding. So these are specific amounts of money that are provided by the government to perform particular activities. So for example, we received $2.5 million for developing a program across Campus Alberta on online educational resources. So that's an example of funding that is not part of the base budget, but funding that is still very important for our what's called our consolidated budget, which is our overall revenue picture. And also it enables us to do things that are transformative going forward and to provide leadership in areas where we have particular expertise. So it's a complex thing, but one time I would be very surprised if this is the last time we see budget cuts in the next few years. Bear in mind also that over the last 3 or 4 years, we have had to cut the faculties in terms of the amount of funding that they receive against their expenditures because we have seen really very modest amount coming out of the Campus Alberta grant. And so we have really been hit by this cut on the on a base of other challenges that we've had in our budget, which is one of the things that drove us to that 1.65 contract that I described when we were talking about Azure.
Just to let you folks know, for those of you that have asked a question before, if you're wondering why it's taking so long, I'm giving priority to folks who haven't asked a question yet. So, Councillor Speakman.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you for the presentation, Dr. Roosevelt. I'm wondering what some of the consequences for the institution would be if the provincial government doesn't let us carry the deficit that is planned for the next sort of 3 years of budget, the operating budget over that time scale, what happens if we can't carry that deficit?
Right. No, it will be very difficult. And, I talked about the accelerated and then the under-accelerated process of trying to manage the budget. What that would do is if we were told that that deficit was not acceptable and that we had got to reduce that deficit down faster, it would create that overly accelerated syndrome I talked about, which means that we would be forced in one way or another to make cuts faster and in a more expensive way than we would in the more timely way that we're planning. So it's doable. If it had to be done, it could be quite catastrophic in terms of positions that occur across the university that would be cuttable within that time frame. And it would severely impact the support that our professors receive in terms of being able to do the things that they do in order to teach and do research. It would also place us at risk from the standpoint of meeting regulatory requirements, because what we would be talking about would be taking out some of the positions that are the more senior administrative positions that exist within the faculties, the APOs, and the support staff. They're critically important for us to meet the regulatory requirements we have to meet to get those tri-council grants, those federal grants I described. There's a tremendous amount of administrative overhead we have to meet in order to comply with the regulations that allow us to receive that money. Similarly, the Auditor General within the province has very specific expectations as to what we do from an administrative standpoint in order to comply with provincial regulations. If we take out that much administrative capacity out of the university, it's going to be extremely difficult for us to be able to comply and be successful going forward in relation to federal funding and meeting provincial requirements. So we would strongly recommend that the government trust us moving forward. They have every reason to trust us, because over the last 3 or 4 years, every year we've given them a deficit budget, and we've been able to come in significantly better than the deficit that we've predicted. And so that's because we've been creative, we've worked hard at trying to generate the revenues to bring about the cost savings to do better in terms of the deficit that we projected at the beginning of the year by the time we get to the end. And so we would hope that we could achieve the same thing this year, but they need to trust us that we can do it, rather than the alternative, which would be damaging and expensive.
Councillor Champagne, is your mic working? I can't hear you, Councillor Champagne. Give me a message if you're okay. Just let me check if the volume is turned up. Like any volume control there, so I may, Councillor Champagne, need you to just give me one moment here. Can you hear me now? Or sorry, can you try talking now?
Can you hear me?
There, yes, now we can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you, Doctor, for coming to talk to us today.
Sure.
Here's my question. Considering the cuts we're facing this year and the cuts we're going to be facing in the next few years, the adjustments the university is going to have to make, what are students going to notice? What changes are they going to notice? How is it going to affect the education, the university experience? What changes are they going to absolutely notice?
Yeah, interesting question. It's a difficult one to answer in many ways. Also, will be hugely variable across the university. But let me take one example. One of the things that we've had to do this year is we've had to reduce the available funding for teaching assistantships. And so faculties are right now struggling in order to maintain their normal complement of TAs. So that affects both the graduate students who would have the opportunity to be employed as TAs, and it affects students in terms of the support they're used to getting from TAs. So we haven't eliminated TAs, of course, but what we've had to do is make a reduction in that. So you may find more difficulty in getting TA support than you may have done in the past. There will be some pressure on scholarships that are funded out of base funding. And so we've scholarships, of course, that are provided through philanthropic gifts, they're unaffected by this. But those scholarships that are funded through the operating grant, Campus Alberta grant, there have been some reductions in those scholarships as a result of the budget cuts we've had to make. What we tried to do, within the time frame that we're talking about, which again was measured in a few weeks, we've tried to bring about changes that have had the minimum impact on a number of things. Minimum impact on undergraduate students and graduate students, minimum impact on our ability to raise revenue, and minimum impact on our excellence. So those are the principles that we applied. Those are some examples of some areas where you would see some impact. It's conceivable, I think a little way out, that you'll see a trend that has been occurring over the last 3 or 4 years of increasing student to professor ratios. So there's been a progressive, relatively modest increase in that ratio, and I would expect that that will continue to go up, because as professors leave and we don't replace them, then the workforce of professors will go down. What we're trying to do is to maintain the number of students that we enroll and meet our enrollment target, because if we undershoot our enrollment target, there is a significant possibility that our Campus Alberta grant would be reduced by not meeting the enrollment target. So another thing that could very well happen is, because there is no capacity for growth, what we're seeing is increasing demand in the STEM disciplines from high school students trying to get into the U of A. We've had to raise the admission average into those programs quite steadily over the last few years, and it's very likely that unless we can accommodate the increased demand, that the admission averages to get into the U of A in those disciplines will go up. And we don't want to see that, in that it is not our goal to make the U of A the most difficult place to get into and is only available for the super elite students. In that we want strong students, we want creative students, we want students who are committed to their field of interest. It doesn't necessarily map onto grade point averages. There are other things than just grade point averages in order to admit and engage with the very best students available to us in Alberta and beyond. And so our capacity to accommodate that breadth of student talent gets compromised when the competition to get in becomes sort of as fierce as it is becoming now in the STEM disciplines. So those are a few examples of the things that you probably notice and that we're fighting to try and minimize.
Okay, Councillor Nguyen.
Hi. Thank you for coming and thank you for your presentation. So earlier you mentioned in response to another councillor's question that there wasn't, you couldn't really pinpoint like the cause of why the budget cut was a surprise. You mentioned a few things, but it was hard to, I guess, identify exactly why it was a surprise to all of the leaders of the institutions in Alberta. And you also mentioned that you were working on advocating for the U of A to, I guess, to reduce budget cuts, I guess. So what efforts specifically have been made to really openly communicate with you, communicate to the U of A about the future budget situation so that in the future, if there's a budget cut or increase, it doesn't come as a surprise, and so that the U of A can actually plan for it. Not in like a month, but rather like over the course of the year, longer term.
So I think it's a really interesting question, because I think that one of the things that's probably most important in being successful in ensuring that we protect our future. Well, let me give you a few examples. One would be, we need to be unified in our voice, in the value we associate with the university degree of the caliber that you get at the U of A. I think we need to be able to speak both as students and as faculty members and as other employees at the university, as parents, as every member of the community in Alberta. We need to be able to say why this is important, and we need to be actively out there advocating for it. And I think we need to be very cautious about finding ourselves divided and rifts created between, for example, university administration or university professors or students. And I think that active discussion to try and establish a clear understanding of what that message is really important. I think that other things that are critically important is the need to emphasize the importance of obtaining an excellent education defined in its full breadth. And so I think there is a prevailing belief among some people, I think it's a minority, that somehow you go to university in order to get a training for a specific job. And I'm sorry, I just don't see it that way. Our colleagues in medicine may be slightly different, but in general, what I would say is that we go to university in order to create a sort of platform. It's an educational platform for ourselves, our personal areas of interest and expertise and personal strengths. And what we then do in life after that is we build on that platform. So that platform comprises of things of some knowledge, but a lot of skill. And that skill includes things like critical thinking, it includes communication, it includes the social skills that are very important if you're going to be successful in any environment, whether it's a social environment or a workplace environment. But there is a package of those things that you need if you're going to be a truly successful leader in our society going forward. Our expectation of a U of A graduate is that you guys are going to be the leaders of the future. You're going to define the province and beyond for the future. So that platform is critical. And the platform doesn't need to be a particular specialist area. It could be a liberal arts background. It could be a very broadly based background. Or it could be an engineer who's done courses in the arts or courses in other areas of science to enable that person to have a full appreciation of knowledge and the skills necessary to be successful. Then later on in life, they build on that. They do additional courses. They get their work experiences. They become thoughtful people. They read about it. We teach people to go out and to read and be inquisitive. And those are the things that those are the skill sets we need you to lead with. And that we need to better communicate that value of the platform, not the value of the fact that we've just prepared you to become a physical therapist, or we've prepared you to become a nurse, or prepared you to become, you know, a pump engineer. Those are all important attributes, but they're not as important as getting the platform right. And that's the most important thing, in my view, about an undergraduate education. And that's what I think we do so well here, not to say we couldn't do better. I think, finally, I think we need to better communicate our aspirations, what we think the university is heading towards. We need to say why the university is important to the economy of the province, not just in terms of innovation, but in terms of creating a workforce that is internationally competitive and effective and creative. And that the university training and education that you get prepares you to be that kind of person. And I think that we need to be really clear about the fact that we are truly entrepreneurial in our approach as a university, that we're looking at new ways of doing things. So you'll be hearing about a MOOC, for example, that we're going to be launching that will be a world-class MOOC. It'll probably be the best MOOC ever done. That's what I genuinely believe we're going to be able to announce in September. Now, that's because we've got people who are ambitious, they're incredibly hardworking, and they've got vision. And we need to get behind that, and we need to support that person who's going out on a limb, taking huge personal risks in terms of their reputation, because they believe that if they're successful, they'll help to redefine the way we do education, or we'll be able to redefine various different technologies that can be embedded within our educational processes. So communicating those aspirations and setting them as expectations so that our government doesn't expect that somehow or other we will have an okay university system in the province, but we will have the stellar educational system in Canada and beyond. And we should be setting that expectation. We can afford it. We have the resources, we have the money, we have the talent, we have a vision. And we need to get that out there, but we need to do that jointly. It can't be done by me or by the president or the board chair or Petros. All of us.
It's been an hour. We can stay about another half hour. Just wonder if people have other questions.
In fact, I was going to say, I was going to slip one more question in before our time is up, unless anyone would care to extend. Vice President Chung?
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to extend to suspend standing orders to allow the presentation to continue until
7:38 to 7:39 now, I guess. 7:39. Do we have a seconder for that motion? Councillor Graham, thank you very much. All those in favour? Any objection? Or any opposed, excuse me? That motion carries. Okay, we will continue on. Councillor Mohammed.
Yes. Earlier when you talked about marketing modifiers, you said that our law school tuition was on the low side compared to Canada. But I looked at the top 15 law schools in Canada, and I found the average, and it was $11,000. The U of A's law school tuition is $11,000. The U of T's law school tuition is $25,000. What you said earlier about us being on the low side seems to be incorrect. So how do you explain this?
Well, this is I obviously don't have the advantage of the internet. I should have right in front of me. I've had that in my office, sorry. But what I would say is this, that where we position ourselves as a university is in the top five of the U15. We're not in the middle of the U15. We're in the top five of the U15. So in terms of the level of excellence, the quality of the law school that we have, I would not be placing it right there at the median, I think, in the way you've described it. I would be looking for us to be at the top 20%, I would imagine, of law schools, if you like, in Canada. And I would be interesting to see if we would set that question as to where, are the top 20% universities in Canada, and where does their tuition lie? I would suggest under those circumstances we're probably below. I know, Colleen, do you have anything to add to that? You probably know these figures better than me.
Right, no, you're exactly right. It's very much in terms of who our characters are, and not that far.
Is that okay with me?
The U of T law school is ranked as number 10, but they have tuition that's $25,000.
Right, yeah, like, 25,000 against 11, right?
Yeah, I don't see how more money equals a better program.
Doesn't necessarily. I think that you have to be careful about leaping. We have to be careful about leaping to that conclusion. And I think that we are, I think, aspiring to see that if there were an increase in tuition through a market modifier, that we would also see associated value added in association with doing that. Now, stories I hear may be wrong, but the stories I hear around law school and actually business school in Toronto is that top choice for students going to law school or business school in Canada. And one of the reasons for that is because they have outstanding placement opportunities. So these are articling opportunities or opportunities to be like a business resident, as you would call it in medicine, if you like. And so this is an opportunity for you to get training through workplace experiences. One of the reasons for that, of course, is in Toronto there are a lot of businesses out there that that have created wonderful opportunities for those students. So one of the things I would be expecting us to do is, if we were to apply a market modifier like that, is look very closely and strategically at the articling and the placement opportunities for students in that program to make sure that they get a comparative experience. Now, this is not directly within the control of the professoriate of the U of A that's teaching the law program, who teach an outstanding program. but it's building the relationships with our community so that those students that come to the ULA would have outstanding community-based experiences. That may take additional resources, and that's probably where the sort of market modifier type of resources could be directed. Now, that would be at the discretion of the dean, but it's the sort of discussion that we would have with the dean, or you could have with, if you were in the law school, you could have within the law school through the faculty council to set some expectations, as we did in many other market modifier situations, as to what we're going to expect as a result of increasing that market, that tuition level. So it's not a just increase it and everything else stays the same. In many other cases where we've increased the tuition through a market modifier, we've added other expectations for improving the quality or the scope or the experience. There's no reason why you shouldn't be able to negotiate that too. But all of those things take resources. So I'm in rehab medicine normally, dean of rehab medicine. We provide hundreds and hundreds of clinical placements for our students. They need an enormous amount of coordination. They need a lot of support from clinician staff members who create those clinical experiences for our students to make sure they're worthwhile, that they're good and productive, that the assessment of the students is fair and equitable. It's a really complex process. But we have the market modifier associated with our tuition that enables us to afford those staff members to create those opportunities. That's why you need some of those additional costs on some of those tuitions in order to ensure you create those experiences. Otherwise, what you do is you create a ho-hum experience because you haven't got the resources to make it work. And that impacts upon the reputation of the whole program, and then it reflects upon the students that will come to your program. So there is a closely entwined process there. Thank you.
Sorry, I don't know your name. Go ahead.
Well, thank you. My name is Ryan Dunch. I'm a professor, actually. Thank you to the council for allowing visitors to ask questions. I wasn't going to the extra time at all. Let's say that we're successful in cutting, you know, the $26 million this fiscal year, and the remaining $56 to $58 million, either in the succeeding 1 year or the succeeding 2 years. And you use the term sustainable because we've heard a lot in the last few years about the cost drivers of around 4 to 4.5% a year built into the system that we have at the university. So simply getting us down to a lower starting point actually does not make it sustainable unless you can do something about those cost drivers.
Right.
How do we address that as an institution?
Right. So this goes back to 18 months ago when we made our first step in that direction, when we came in with a modest increase. I think that was the first step. But I think at the same time we set up the Renaissance Committee. The Renaissance Committee's mandate was to look at those things that we could do that are related to the way we structure. So they're related to, for example, the way merits get calculated for our professors. It looks at the compensation mechanisms associated with start-up new assistant professors versus mature, well-established, well-proven professors, and how you distribute the resources among those different stages of someone's career, and try and get a distribution that is creating strong incentives for excellence among up-and-coming professors, and trying to ensure that we are successful in growing our own as well as bringing in, as we've had to over the last 10 years, a relatively large number of people who we've brought in at the full professor level, which is, of course, quite an expensive process to do. So a lot of those structural things need to be addressed. And so this is a joint initiative between the university and Ashua. There are equal numbers of representatives on the Renaissance Committee who are looking at these questions. They're also looking at things like pensions and so on. So a lot of the cost drivers that are within the institution that are essentially structural, they're long-term, being looked at the Renaissance Committee. So the Renaissance Committee will produce its report, which will be a joint report in November. No one else in Campus Alberta has anything like this, even beginning to have anything like this. So again, we're pioneering this sort of thinking about some of these structural situations that are certainly not unique to the U of A. They're certainly not unique to Alberta. And the report will come in November, and then there will be a proposal put to the ASHRAE membership in the new year, I believe in February. And then, depending upon the outcome of that, those measures can then be built into the next round of the collective agreement. So we put in place a thoughtful, detailed process, a radical process back 18 months ago that is really attempting to address some of the points you raised. I don't think it's the panacea, but address all of them. It's certainly, this was a change, you know, dramatic change to have this size of cup. It's not anticipated, so Renaissance wasn't designed to work at that scope, that level of impact. But even so, I think it will be a mechanism that will help in those long-term structural issues we need to look at. One of the other things it's looking at is creating a potential career track that would be for what we would describe as teaching intensive professors. So professors whose focus is on teaching excellence and teaching innovation, and maybe a little less emphasis on what we would describe as traditional research. So these are all things that are built into that initiative. I think it's transformative in nature. We'll have to see what they come up with.
Back. So I'd also like to thank the SU for letting us crash the party here at the TSA. So when you talk about the market modifiers, it seems to me that what you're saying is that if market modifiers are implemented, students will see an increase in services that are offered. But that won't happen until this budget crisis is dealt with. So what is the time frame if market modifiers are implemented that we actually see those benefits that you're talking about?
Yeah, well, I think there are improvements that can be brought about. A part of the discussion, part of the conversation around the market modifier, it gives you a focus for negotiation. And so when the market modifier discussion is started, there are things that you can discuss that may not actually be significantly expensive to implement. But what you're doing is you're creating a forum for discussion around what the expectations are of the program. And we've seen that happen in previous market modifier discussions. So I wouldn't just purely associate the increased income associated with market modifier with an improvement that can only be brought about through expenditure. But the key point is that when that market modifier is brought about, it does a number of things. It does, a proportion of that funding comes into central administration in order to support the cross-cutting programs that we have. These include Dean of Student Services, the Registrar's Office, supporting our website, those kinds of things, those cross-cutting facilities. So some of that will come in to help to support those areas that would otherwise have to be cut, because there wouldn't be the funding to give them the level of support they need. And the other is that a significant proportion of that funding goes back to the faculty, and that can do a couple of things. In the short term, it can help to mitigate cuts that would otherwise have had to have been made. In the longer term, this becomes an ongoing permanent source of funding, and that it should be possible, as time progresses, for the dean to be able to direct resources towards that program, towards that market modifier, part of their program, and to maybe grow the number of students in due course. That becomes an incentive to grow the students in that program because it becomes a revenue source for the faculty, and that enables the faculty to grow and develop. So it's a dance. I mean, it's not a really simple process, but the organic aspect of this can result in quite significant improvements in student programs for all sorts of reasons.
Thank you.
Okay.
Councillor Winarski.
The solution requires sacrifices by academic faculty and students. What sacrifices would be borne by the administration?
Right. Good question. So first thing we need to define among ourselves is what we mean by administration, because I think the natural tendency is to look at me and say administration, right? And Colleen is administration, Vaughn is administration. But these were the administration who sort of hang out in the South Academic Building, the university central administration, if you like. But actually embedded throughout the university are large numbers of people who are providing administrative support for you to be able to do the things you do successfully as students. And so there is a continuum there There isn't a sort of a brick wall between what goes on in central administration and what goes on in administration within faculties, what goes on in the registrar's office, what goes on in the library. They're all very closely intertwined. So if we already have, when you look at our expenditures on central administration, we have the provincial figure is that 3.5% of our budget is spent on administration. The Auditor General's goal is 5%. So we're already achieving well under the Auditor General's standard for the amount of administrative expenditure in order to run a nearly $2 billion operation. So realize the complexity, realize the interdependencies that exist. One of the problems that can arise is if we specifically identify, for whatever reason, that it's central administration that we want to cut, that that will have a downloading effect on the faculties. So if it's not being done by us, and it has to be done, and if it doesn't have to be done, we should certainly not be doing it, but if it has to be done, which most of it does, much of it is driven through regulation, then we have to download it onto the faculties. And that then impacts upon the effectiveness of the faculties, who are already really stretched in terms of the amount of administrative support that they've got. So if that's what we mean by administration, then all I would do is say urge caution in that we took 3% out of administration this year, we took 1.5% out of the faculties this year. So we doubled the impact on administration, in central administration compared to the faculties. And we've done that consistently one way or another over the last 3 or 4 years. So we've stripped a lot of important functions out of central administration in order to try and preserve as much as we could in the faculties. If you mean beyond that, if you mean, you know, senior leadership in some way, then I think it's really important to get the terminology right. You know, if it's senior leadership that you want to see changes in, then what I would say is that in the provost office this year, we've taken out 2 vice provosts out of how many do we have? 10? 8? About 10. 20% of the vice provosts have gone. One in health sciences and the other one in faculty relations. So we've done it. We don't necessarily spread this all over the Edmonton Journal. We don't really want to do that. We don't want to be provocative. But you have to know that we're trying to be really responsible with those central administration resources.
You took the personal leave beams as well?
Yep. That's, so from beams upwards, nearly everybody took voluntarily 5 days leave without pay. And that's equivalent to
1.92%
cost
saving. Actually, not taking the salary.
Yeah, so that's a significant reduction over and above the 1.65. So things like that are being done. We're not trumpeting them. We don't want to be provocative. We also don't want to be inflammatory by, you know, if we've done this, you've got to do this. You know, setting up a competition like that is not the healthy way to go forward. We're trying to do what we believe are the responsible things.
Councillor Speakman.
Thanks. At the beginning of your presentation, you said maybe we could talk have a discussion about expectation of outcomes. So
yes.
I was interested by what you said there, and I wanted to speak to that from a counselor perspective. And as an undergraduate student, what I'm really focused on is my own education, and I think that that's what a lot of my peers, and I'm in the Faculty of Science, would say. And some of the things in the comprehensive institutional plan seem pretty far removed from what we experience as students. So my expectation of outcomes for the U of A doesn't really relate to being competitive in the international arena or top 15 universities or like that. So I just think that if U Alberta doesn't focus on this local issue of the reduced Campus Alberta grant, and what seems to me is a province that doesn't invest or isn't investing currently in post-secondary education, then some of the aspirations to excellence we'll just never get there because of issues going on at home, kind of, as it were. And I think that those goals don't have to be canceled or abandoned, but leaving them on the table for later. And and that the budget cuts represent an urgent issue that requires the university to take a sort of step back from those other goals, just to deal with that for now so that we can become that excellent and competitive university in the future.
Right. If I might ask, what are you thinking of doing once you completed your science? What science degree are you doing, by the way?
I'm in ecology.
Ecology. So what are you thinking of doing after that?
Well, it's a little awkward because I'm going to move back to Victoria, BC. Sorry.
But you'll take hopefully good messages about the U of A with you.
Yeah, I really will. I want to work in nature. I want to save the trees and the whales.
Right. Yeah. Like a true BC person. So what I would say is this, that probably right there and then, but certainly at some point in your career, the buying power of your degree is going to be really important, in that it will be important for you to get a job, to be competitive, to maybe get further education. Not just what we've taught you, what you've hopefully remembered from what we've taught you as well, but also just the reputation, in that the reputation of the U of A will stand you in really good stead when you sit there in an interview and you're looking at a potential job and they'll say, well, what university did you go to? What degree did you do? And to have the U of A as an internationally renowned university, as the place that recognized you for the excellence that you've been doing as a student, is really important in terms of your buying power, in terms of you securing your goal. And so I would strongly recommend that should be forefront in our minds about why it's important the U of A should be kept strong and that its reputation should be kept strong, and that despite all of these problems, we need to go out there and preserve that above all else. So if I understood your question correctly, I think preserving our reputation for quality has to be foremost. Now, the question of well, what are we focusing our efforts on? Here we've got this aspirational CIP, and then we've got all of these nitty-gritty problems. Well, believe me, we're really engaged with those nitty-gritty problems. But the format, the expectation, the nature of the information that is disclosed in a document like a CIP tends to be the sort of thing you've seen. In fact, people have commended our CIP for being an outstandingly good CIP. And it is a public document, and I think it does help to communicate our reputation and our aspirations and the kind of place we are. So I think it is important from that standpoint. But beneath that broad set of aspirations, the details of what we have to do to be excellent and to stay excellent consume every hour we have. And so I don't want you to imagine that that represents our daily work. It just doesn't. It really represents where we believe the university should be going, what it stands for. But in order to secure that, we have to work like crazy in order to mitigate all of these pressures that are on us. And so that is a document rather like an annual report can be. You know, you tend to put all the good news out there. You tend to put the aspirations out there. You can't write damning negatives, comprehensive institutional plan, any more than you would write a damning negative annual report, because those have a negative spiral effect. What you have to do is to make the best of what you've got, to represent it as strongly as you can, talk about your aspirations, your visions, and your dreams. You know, the fact your dream is to be in ecology, you know, you should be able to get everyone excited about your dream, about why you want to do that, and why you want to study whales or preserve trees or whatever. You need to be able to communicate that really effectively. That's your CIP, right? Even though, you know, you might struggle from time to time throughout your undergraduate career, you still want to hang on to that.
Mr. Novak.
Thank you. Thanks for
coming.
I was just wondering what your position was on the potential option of reducing the receipts in programs as a way to reduce some costs.
Sorry, what you said, I didn't quite catch that.
Sorry, I was just wondering what your position and your office's position was on reducing the number of seats and programs.
Oh, okay, right.
As a
right.
way of offsetting costs. And
yes. Stuff. Something, I think for reasons I gave earlier on, we're really resisting doing, because the effect of doing that is to make it even more difficult for students to get in. So it has a significant impact on access. Medicine is a classic example. It's already extremely difficult to get into medicine, and to make it even more difficult, can have perverse effects in that to have only people with outstandingly good GPAs going into medicine isn't necessarily going to result in the best doctors, any more than doing the same thing in engineering is going to result in the best engineers. It's a complex mix of individual characteristics that are needed for a successful doctor, and we need the scope to be able to do that. We need the wriggle room, if you like, in the admission criteria to make sure that we can look at those other characteristics and just simple GPA or similar measures of academic performance. And so those are the reasons why we are trying not to reduce the number of seats at the U of A. In addition to that, once we go below our target, we lose money in that we're funded. The funding model that we work under is one that funds us for what are called FLEEs, full load equivalents. And so different programs have different levels of full load equivalents, but those full load equivalents are what give us our income to the university. If we drop below the prescribed the number of full load equivalents, then we get less money, and then that has a significant impact in all sorts of areas. No good reason to do it unless we really have to.
Okay, President Kuzma, you've been on my list for a little while, but you've been kind of deferring. Do you care to have the last question, or should I pass on down?
Yeah, sure, it depends on the time.
We'll probably have time for just one more question, so I'm not sure.
Well, I just wanted to make a statement to say.
Okay, well, I'll do that after then. I'll go to Councilor Bannister.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you so much for your presentation. I was wondering if you could provide the Council with some concrete examples on how the office and the administration is reaching out to the student body, the student body as a whole, not necessarily through the Students' Union or any other manner, some concrete examples of how you're communicating the budget deficit and how you're dealing with it.
Yeah, that's a good point, and I'm not sure that we've had the opportunity to really roll that out yet. In that, as I said, the 13-14 budget was very rushed because of all the circumstances I described, and that now we're just beginning to get the 14-15 budget process moving forward. So this is what we're doing. We've had one 8-hour mini retreat with all of the deans. We're having a second one this Friday. The outcome of those two retreats with the deans will be an action plan, what we would describe as a provisional action plan, going forward, that has been informed by the senior executive leaders of the university, the deans. Right? What we'll then be doing is we'll be rolling that action plan out. So we would like to bring this to discuss with student leaders and then the student bodies in a wider environment, such as GFC. There's no reason why this shouldn't be communicated through websites, through the gateway and other mechanisms. And there are plenty of online ways of people feeding back to us. It's one of the preferred ways of doing it because it actually results in a detailed and thoughtful set of recommendations. But also, we intend to hold early in September a town hall that Phyllis Clark, who's the Vice President for Finance and Operations, will be doing. And then there will be the State of the University that the President will be doing on the 19th of September. So you're all welcome to come along to both of those two. So those are two forums in which I think we're going to be having some substantial discussions about things like the content of the action plan. And those are the concrete things that I can think of right now. But if you have ways that you think I could do it better, if you have suggestions as to how I can more effectively communicate through the student organization, maybe through Petros, please let me know, because we really need to do this. And as I said a while back, you know, the more we can do this together, the more we can make this a communication that is joint between the professors, the administration, and the students, the more effective we're going to be, the better we're going to come out the other end.
Councillor Hodgson, like a 2-minute question. Like
thank
question
you.
And answer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So you mentioned earlier the Dean's letters, which we haven't actually really been able to figure out what's in them. And the other part of this question was the operations budget. The university has changed how it presents its budget, now presents only a consolidated budget. So my question is, without access to the Dean's letter, the operating budget, and other resources, how are we as students expected to advocate towards the university about what our interests are and what we would like to see change when we don't have access to the proper information.
Right. So the Dean's Letter issue that arose is, I should explain it to you. I know I should explain it to you, but the first point is that the information that's presented to the deans in those deans' budget letters is actually very brief. It's very general, and is very specific to the faculty, and it needs a great deal of interpretation. So what we do is when we send that letter to the deans, it gives them a broad idea as to what we have had to do in terms of their budget, but in very broad categories. It's then up to the deans to then huddle with their faculty executive, their faculty council, and their own administrative team, and come back to us, usually within a month, with a much more detailed budget that's specific to that faculty. What we also expect the dean to do is to communicate the budget for that faculty going forward to their community and beyond. So we've encouraged the deans to, when they have sorted through that information and they've come up with the details of their plan, to communicate that to their faculty. And there's nothing secret about that. And that information can be communicated through newsletters on websites or whatever. The one thing that we've been very sensitive about, and this has been a long-standing tradition of the U of A, is that difficulties can arise when you get into a situation where faculties start pitted against each other, where one faculty takes a cut in one area and another one doesn't. Well, why didn't I get cut? Why did they get it and I didn't get cut? So what you then get is some negative competition between faculties over that. Now, the thing is that this year in particular, what we did, which is something we haven't really done in previous years, is we applied what we described as differential cuts. So what we decided was that rather than just do across the board, everyone gets a 2% cut across the board and we're done, what we did was we actually identified specific budget areas where we felt some faculties were more able to cope than others or were in a better position to be able to make a cut of a particular type. And so what happened was there's a high level of granularity between faculties, which would feed into this concern about negative competition between faculties or negative comparisons being made by people that even don't understand the details of those budgets. So that was the reason why those budget letters were for the eyes of the deans specifically and then for the deans to do the communicating around it. And that was what our expectation was. Now, going to your question about the consolidated budget, well, this is something that was not something that was initiated by the U of A. This has been established as a provincial accounting standard, and it's called PSAB. And what PSAB requires is that we now submit a consolidated budget, and that embedded within that consolidated budget is some basic information about the operating budget. But this is a change that has had to be made this year. Was it made last year as well? The first year it was done. So, you know, a coincidence in terms of what was going on with the budget. But we were required by the Auditor General in order to implement the consolidated budget model against the provincial standards of accounting. So that's the story. What I do intend to do, and we just haven't got it organized yet, but Petros and I and a couple of others of your executive team are going to get together, and I'm going to have a somewhat confidential conversation to give a little bit more information about the way we went about this in a way that I think is probably more information shared with your president than we've actually shared with some of the other organizations. So we are trying to go out of our way to instill confidence in you in the way we did it. And so what I'm hoping is an outcome of that conversation with Petros is that he'd be able to come back to you and say, well, look, I've gone through it with administration. We've looked at what it was done and why it was done the way it was. And I can tell you that it was reasonable, that it was fair, and that it was thoughtful. And I'm just hoping that we can instill that confidence. That way we then don't get into this negative comparison problem, which is what really bothers me, especially when it gets out into the public domain, out into the media, and people start interpreting it in all sorts of ways that can be quite damaging to the institution.
OK. Okay, we're a couple minutes over time. President Kuzma, do you want a 20-second
code? Sure. I just wanted to say thanks to the Acting Provost and his team for coming out tonight, and thank you to all the counselors, faculty association leaders, guests, non-students, profs, or graduate students, for coming out and asking all the excellent questions, and we're, again, hoping to continue this dialogue further. So thanks a lot. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Get your USB key for you here. I forget these everywhere.
I know.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Okay, folks, we'll take 30 seconds if anyone is wanting to leave after that presentation, just so we can do that sort of gracefully. Okay, folks, we're going to come back here. One other, announcement that I missed during speaker's business. If you look on your main agenda package on the second page, items 7C and 7D are both being withdrawn. So item 7C, motion to create an engagement task force, is being withdrawn, and item 7D, to appoint members to said withdrawn task force. So item 7C and 7D. Absolutely. We'll get it going right away here. So yeah, if you guys want to pop on in here, by all means. Item 2B, Unity Students Council, sponsored by Councillor Lau and Vice President Lau and President Kuzmu. Any objection to hearing this presentation? Councillor Greenhand, is that an objection or is that okay? So we will take a vote. We have a seconder already. All those in favor? Excuse me. This is a debatable motion. So any debate first? We're debating hearing the motion item 2B. Any debate? Councillor Greenhand?
I just don't think this is an entirely appropriate topic for us to come up here, just given the constraints that we have with the rest of our agenda. And this is something that I would have liked to defer to the engagement task force, but I think that is just a shadow of the agenda. I don't know. I think it's just given the time crunch.
Thank you. Councillor Minarski? Councillor Minarski?
I'm in favor of this motion. I first found out about Unity last year. Basically, you just sit down with a friend and you have tea, and it's great. I think it's built a wonderful thing for this campus, and I hope that council will benefit.
Thank you. Vice President Lau.
I would also like to speak in favor of the presentation because school is coming up right away. If we don't see the presentation at this meeting, then the time constraints will hit because the next meeting is going to be pretty much August. And if we don't have some structures in place for counselors to engage with students, school's going to start, and we don't want to miss any marketing opportunities that we have in the school.
Thank you. Councillor Mohammed?
Call the question.
Motion to call the question. Unless there's any more speakers, I'll just take that as a... Are there any other speakers? Okay, we're going to go to a vote then anyway, so I won't even need the vote to call the question. So, item 2B, all those in favor of item 2B?
Mr. Wood,
Vice President Woods?
Is that to vote against the presentation?
No, sorry, so that would be to vote. If you're voting in favor, it would be in favor of having the presentation.
Okay.
If you're voting against, it would be to vote against having the presentation. So all those in favor, is that a point of information?
Yes.
Councillor Bannister, on a point of parliamentary inquiry, excuse me.
Yes, I don't know if this is a point of parliamentary inquiry. How long is this presentation scheduled for?
Presentations by default have 30 minutes allocated to them.
Give me less than that.
They happen, so, I mean, unless the rules are set somewhere else. So, all those in favor of item 2B? Any opposed?
Okay, that motion is carried. So with that, I'll give you a couple of minutes to get it set up.
Oh, so you guys have been sitting down for like the last 2 hours. I understand that could be painful, so if anyone wants to go to the washroom right now, feel free to do so. I'm just going to set up, so you guys got like 5 minutes anyway, so.
If you guys do choose to leave, just a note, because we're not in formal recess, we're just going to go right into it as soon as it's ready, so...
Oh, sometimes it takes a minute to... started here.
So, 4 years ago, I almost got kicked out of university. My grades were just embarrassing. I had no idea what I was doing, and I just seemed lost. I felt like I had no connection to my faculty, and I felt like I didn't even belong here. It turns out, all I needed was for my voice to be heard. It only took one conversation for things to turn around. So this is Unity. Tea and one-to-one conversation. The reason why I started Unity was so that students on campus could have an opportunity to have meaningful conversation. Now, this is a conversation that goes beyond the surface. This is a chance for students to get mentorship, to create friendship, and to create community on campus.
Sorry.
So how? How do we create a platform that engages students, that allows students to have these opportunities to connect? How do we accomplish this? So for the last year, students, faculty, and alumni have been going to unity.org to sign up to either participate or to volunteer. After signing up, they're able to send a request to meet up for tea. So in this example, it's just a student asking to meet up at sub for tea and conversation. Now, during the sign-up process, we're able to figure out what faculty these students are from, what their dreams are, and what their aspirations are. So we're able to connect volunteers and participants on a way so that they have common ground going into these conversations. And once a request is made, we're able to find a time and a place that is convenient for both the participant and for the volunteer. So in this example, they're going to meet at the sub on Tuesday at 4:30. Now this is where Open Locker comes into play. So Open Locker is a locker locator located across campus, and this is where all the tea supplies are located. So it's opened via a word combination, which the volunteers have access to. And inside the locker, you can see that there's tea supplies, there's snacks, and there's your kettle. So this allows something like Unity to be free, so that no one has to pay anything for this kind of opportunity. We've been fortunate enough to establish a supportive community. People have been donating to these open lockers, so it's a way that we can be very sustainable and that we can continue running on campus. Now, as for location, for the past year, we've been running out of just the business building, and it was the purpose for this was to prove its viability. It's a concept that actually works. It's something that volunteers can actually have access to, and it's something that works on campus. Now, over the past year, we've been able to raise enough funding so that open lockers can be located all around campus. So no matter what faculty you're from, no matter where you're on campus, you'll be able to meet up with participants. Now, what does this mean for student council? Well, this is a chance. This is an invitation for you directly to reach out to students on campus. This is a way to engage with them. This is a way to have meaningful conversation. This is a way to actually reach out so that you're known. Make your presence known on campus, so people actually know that a council exists. To be honest with you, up until a month ago, I had no idea that council even existed. Like, something's off here. Everyone on campus is excited around election time. Everyone wants to get out the vote. Everyone wants to participate during that time. Everyone's excited, but only for that moment of time. Right after, what happens? Right after, where is the council presence? We students don't know. I'm entering my fifth year of university, and for me just to find out that a council exists, something's wrong in there. So this is a chance to establish a better understanding of your constituency. Since we know where our participants, what faculty they're from, we can connect you directly with the students in the faculty. This way you can understand their needs, their concerns. What are they thinking about during in campus, and what's affecting them, what's affecting their student life? It's a two-way street. The better you know your constituents, the better they can know you. It must be frustrating to put all this hard work in, all these efforts, all this time, just for it to go unnoticed. If people that don't know if you exist on campus, then all that hard work can't be acknowledged. this is a chance for you to raise awareness of all the projects you're working on, raise awareness of everything that's going on during your meetings, during your hard work, a way to increase transparency, a way to communicate to them all the hard work that you're putting in to your position. Most importantly, this is a chance just to build community on campus. This is your time. This is your time to be the generation of council that actually is known on campus. This is it's time. Like, you can step forward and you can participate, you can volunteer, you can get hands-on. This is not something that you're going to delegate to some task force, to some other person. This is a time that you can actually reach out. Reach out to the students that got you elected in the first place. It's time. It's time to get hands-on. It's time to build community on our campus. The more we understand each other, the more we can fulfill each other's needs. The more students know you as council people that actually were productive and that made a profound impact on campus. This way, everyone can know each other on campus and everyone can build a strong community. It's time. You can be the first council to do so. So let's work together. Let's get this done. All the resources are in place. All the funding's in place. The only thing that Unity is asking of you today is just to volunteer. These conversations, they're anywhere from like half an hour to an hour. But what happens during that half an hour to an hour? The effect you can have on these students. The way you can educate them about what's going around campus, what opportunities are available, what you've been working on, and the amount that you can understand. The amount you can be educated as a counselor, knowing what their needs are, what they're going through, and what you can help them with. It's a two-way road at this school, and the closer we are, the closer we can create a community, the better. So let's start today. Thank you for your time.
Would you mind hitting the lights back up just so I can take questions? So, are there any questions for our presenter? Councillor Speakman?
Where do you keep the table and chairs?
So, during the movie, we rented the table and chairs. Popular places around campus are places like ECHA, places like Sub, places that are public, so that it's a safe place to meet, and places where there's a table available.
Councillor Bannister?
Just out of curiosity, do you have an estimate of how many meetings took place in your last, like, year that you were operating?
So we had 93 people sign up to become members, and we've gotten over 50 conversations on campus.
Okay, cool.
With how many volunteers?
We have 3 to 5 volunteers that are actually active, and we have a list of 30 people that want to get involved.
I'll remind Vice President Blau that I have a speakers list. Okay. Councillor Binchik.
Thank you for your presentation. I have something about the meeting. I'm just wondering whether you're looking also for volunteers to coordinate in meetings as well. Is it just you send out all the presentations?
Yeah, definitely. Like, help on the back end with like that kind of coordination would help. So, like, asking for volunteers doesn't always necessarily mean that you're going to be meeting with people. Like, having people in the back and, like, supporting is definitely something that we need as well.
Any questions, Councillor Speakman?
How do you differentiate between participants and volunteers?
Okay, so on the website, go to it. There's 2 different sign-up stages. You can sign up to either join Unity as a member, so then that's where you're participating, or you can sign up to volunteer as well.
So, does each meeting have 1 participant and 1 volunteer?
Yeah, so it's 1-to-1 conversation. We found that having a group bigger than 1-to-1, people are more reluctant to share things that go beyond the surface. When you're just there with 1 person, it's a lot easier to open up.
Additional questions? Seeing none, I'd like to thank our presenter. Thanks.
Yeah, so if you want to go to the website, it's at unity.org, and there you can find out more information about what we're doing. You can sign up or you can volunteer. Thanks.
I'll sign you out of Gmail. All right. Thank you very much. With that, we will move on to executive committee reports. Any executives that care to give an oral report? Only once. President Kuzma? I'm not sure. Go ahead first.
Okay, absolutely. So, just wanted to give my apologies to council for not submitting my report. This is the first and only time all my reports have always been on the main agenda. That being said, I was finally on my first vacation or time off last week, so it's my birthday. So it felt nice to finally take some time off and actually rest, which was cool. But I couldn't completely rest. I spent most of Tuesday working, and Friday we had a meeting the entire day. But it was still productive. With that being said, last week not too much happened while I was away from the office. Before that, we met with executives from the Auburn Sound Students Association. It was a blast. We had a chance to catch up. I think something we've been talking about within the executive is actually meeting with all the different faculty associations, so we can have a chance to get to know them a little bit better. Also met with representatives from the Gateway. We had a nice chat. And this is all kind of off the top of my head. For the most part, things are running smoothly. We're still working on the fall reading we filed. We're still waiting for some individuals to get back to us so we can actually have some meetings, but for the most part, things are kind of calm and steady. Tomorrow is going to be exciting, though. We're going to have our tuition and mandatory non-instructional fee budgetary advisory committee, and that's where we'll actually get the chance to talk about the international differential fee in greater length and detail with the university's vice president of finance and administration and the acting provost as well. So that next council report should be really, really insightful and exciting, hopefully, depending on how much information they give up. But with that being said, keep your eyes closed on the next council.
Thank you. Vice President Lay.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I just have 2 points to discuss about. As you all know, the Daily Grind, our future coffee shop, will be opening soon. And today and later this week, we're having our potential coffee suppliers present to an internal group in the SU. But on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of next week, we're going to have taste tests of the coffee supplies. They'll be blind, and you'll be able to send it's your vote for what you want the next coffee to be for the Daily Grind. So I think Monday will be a dark roast, Tuesday will be a medium roast, and Wednesday will be a light roast. I'll send out information with more concrete details. We'll be by the sub food court, but we'd love to hear your opinion. Today I probably drank like 15 cups of coffee. Yeah, so it's pretty interesting. But I'll have to get you all involved with that as well, too, because that's something that the councilors have expressed interest in. The second piece, I'm not sure if it was mentioned yet. But the exec have been talking about ways to get council out in the open relating to the whole engagement task force. But one of the ways we were thinking to do that is to get counselors' photos taken. So we've spoken with some photos, and they've agreed to take photos of each individual counselor free of charge. And we're going to use those photos to put onto the SU website, but also to put onto the wall of gold, which is the wall just outside of somewhere. And so it would be a great way to appreciate and to highlight the student representatives that we have and all that you do, because you guys, or you folks, are all beautiful and awesome. And so we'll send out information, but you essentially just go to the sub-photo website, just book an appointment, and get your photo taken. It takes about like 15 minutes, but we want to have all the photos done by August, or by early August, so please do so as soon as possible. The sooner the better, because it'll allow the marketing department to have more time to look at it. And you can have a new profile picture or a LinkedIn photo. So I'll send out information on that. But so Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday next week, come for taste tests of coffee samples.
And Vice President Lay, you're out of time.
And council votes.
Just got it. Vice President Lau.
So two quick updates from my end. First off, I've been working kind of hard to push athletic promotions for the beginning of each semester, September and September and January. So we finally got dates for hockey games set for those. It's somewhat unfortunate, but they're going to have to be Saturdays. But the good thing about that too is that we'll have rather half day to full day events and longer events and more bang for the buck, so to speak. So we found a great setup for athletic promotions, and besides that, a few counselors were interested in
And Gateway was interested in UPath issue because we had a student from the Faculty of Law approach me and try to work towards changing the procedures and processes that students go through if they forget their UPath, say, on the LRT. Because the current fine is $250, and we had a first meeting with the transit staff this morning, which was kind of directed towards the municipal prosecutors, since it's more of a process on the procedures within the court rather than the transit. We're moving pretty fast to have we're getting our legal argument set up and we'll be meeting with the prosecutors soon and I'll keep you updated with that.
Thank you. Any other executives? Vice President Woods.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Just very briefly, I said I'd provide a moral update about the Council of Alberta University Students Roundtable taking place in Calgary. Myself and the rest of the executive were in Calgary for Friday and most of Saturday to meet with representatives from the whole execs of both University of Alberta Students Union and University of Calgary Students Union. A very productive roundtable. The boss discussed essentially how we're going to move forward on our goals, and a lot more updates for you as that proceeds on. But at this point, there's a lot of communicating certain MLAs and anybody else we want to discuss about this. I'd also like to update you guys that we had another municipal election campaign meeting today. I'm happy to say that the GSA will be involved in the campaign. We're also setting up bids to the smaller schools like King's and Concordia, not so much to help organize, but just to participate and get the students involved. Please ask any questions if you have any concerns or questions about either of them. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other execs? No. Okay, moving on to board and committee business. Councillor Gordon.
Yeah, we have really fast. So, we're going to get a CRO because we don't have one anymore. Well, I'm sorry. Anyway, it's going to be reposted at the closing date on July 21st because we moved that. And we'll hopefully fill it by, we'll bring it to the council on July 30th. And then we talk to council, like student engagement. And we're looking into volunteering for Eco Welcome for the pancake breakfast on Wednesday. And if you're able to help with that, let us know right away. So because we're going to get some swag, some t-shirts, people that are volunteering. And then council headshots, yada yada. And if people want to be on CAC, there's going to be a motion to be on CAC, but if people want to come, that'd be awesome. I bribed you guys last time with Timbits, and no way, thanks. I'm getting involved now.
Thank you, Councilor Borton. Any other committee chairs? Vice President Lay?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'll be speaking on behalf of the Big Rent Allocation Committee. Next week, I believe, all week, each day, there's going to be presentations from SBIC, the Student Financial Aid and Information Center, about their money management sessions. These are usually intended just for information, but also we send people who receive the access fund to these money management sessions, and it'd be good if you have any, or if you wanted to learn more about the information, then you can recommend it to other students about money management. If you have any interest to do those, let me know, and I'll send you the relevant.
Thank you. Any other board and committee reports? Seeing none, we will carry on to question period. And taking my advice, Councillor Speakman has submitted a couple of written questions, and so they get priority. So, again, anytime you submit written questions, they will take priority, so I encourage you to submit written questions. Item 5A, Vice President Lau, any response? If you have a copy of it, sorry, on the late ads.
So, question 5A about the National Student Services. Well, right now the International Student Services is under the University of Alberta International. It's currently not a student union service, and it does take a lot of work to run. And I think the idea right now that we're looking at is moving International Student Services outside of HUB, because it's currently on the ground floor of HUB, under this kind of, it's really hidden. Let's say that. So they are trying to get more visibility and looking for other possible locations. Discussion right now is around where we house them and whether or not they would like to house themselves. We know that's something that they are looking for I don't think they will ever become a student union service since they're really heavily integrated with inside the international department, so to speak. But I'll defer the question also to Vice President Challen and see if there's anything else to add.
Yeah. Not a lot left to add, and I think, with no offense to the Vice President, I think it's important to really talk a little bit bigger about what we're actually looking at, and I think part of our focus is taking a look at finding ways to connect local students with international students, and looking at SU's, what capacities does the SU have to do that. It's not necessarily taking over international student services, it's a huge operation, but what are better ways that we can work with them and find ways to better connect local international students. You know, this is the feedback that they give us all the time, so they just feel really, really excellent that they never have an opportunity to connect. Sort of our main objective.
Thank you. Item 5B, Vice President Lay, any
questions? Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you, Councillor Speaker. I only saw this question at 5 o'clock today, so I didn't get a chance to work through the different contracts, but for the new food court vendors, I guess one of them will be the Daily Grind. One of the operating policies in section 1.04K is that the students shall only purchase fair trade designated coffee, so that's something we aren't changing to pursue, but something that the Internal Sustainability Committee, the committee that arose from the sustainability audit that happened 2 years ago and the recommendations that were developed 1 year ago, we might have within our in the recommendations or in the contracts that the food, I guess, holding, serving, the food holding containers, also called it that, will be fully compostable, because one thing we found is that it's hard to compost when you have to divide all the different articles out separately, as opposed to just being able to throw all your pieces in there. So I think there is work towards having all those, your forks and spoons and knives and containers used stored in the compost bin. So that's something that'll be on there. But I'll have to look a little bit closer and ask the very senior managers for everything, but I will follow up with you on that.
Thank you. Moving on to oral questions, Councilor Bannister.
So I have a question for Vice President Blake. So in your report, you mentioned we're getting like headshots. So are we still going to have that poster with our names on it? Because in my opinion, it seems redundant to have both. Mm-hmm. So are we still going to be having that? Will that be replaced in some capacity?
It will also be there. The headshots will be used for the website purposes, also for the wall of gold, because we found after talking to exec and other counselors that having the names off by the elevators, it's very discreet and unvisited place. And so while it is there, it doesn't achieve the purpose of highlighting our students' council, the highest governing body, and spend 3 hours every single week plus committee meetings. I think it's important for counselors to be empowered and appreciated. And to be on the wall of gold, that'll probably be only a 2 week period, because that's only a temporary time slot. So, voter for you, visibility, also having memories. I can quote this as you.
Thank you. Vice President Lau.
I got a question for President Kuzma. What's the Students' Union's stance on the Don't Be That Girl campaign?
President Kuzma?
Cool. Thank you for the question. That's obviously not planted for me, but it's a question that Governor Kelly asked me via email, and I just wanted to provide council an update on that. So in case you don't know, the Students' Union has something called a Gender-Based Violence Prevention Project, part of the Students' Union, that focuses solely on trying to challenge these systemic problems within our society on gender inequity. So with that being said, we're right now trying to have that office take the lead of it, considering that we have an entire office's job is fully dedicated towards these kind of issues. Right now, I believe the leader of the executive director of that office right now is actually on the way on vacation, but she'll be returning relatively, she'll return this week. And I've already sent an email following up with her, seeing how the project is going to respond to some of these really controversial kind of issues.
Additional questions? A few more minutes. Seeing none, we will close question period. Unless I have one mistake. Nope. Okay, we will close question period. Moving on to board and committee business, item 6A, Chellen moves that, upon the recommendation of the policy committee, students' council renew the quality instruction policy in first reading based on the following principles. One, that instruction refers to the teaching and learning involving instructors. Two, that the state of technology and interdisciplinary don't relate to the objectives of the policy. Three, that the SU should advocate for more mandatory and improved instructor professional development activities, especially those focused on communication. Four, that the SU should advocate for mid-semester formative feedback opportunities. Five, that an effective teaching evaluation mechanism is psychometrically valid and has available results. Do we have a seconder for that motion? Councillor, or excuse me, Vice President Woods, thank you very much. Vice President Chellen to introduce.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So, typical process for policies, both new policies and renewing policies, is that they'll go through the SU's policy committee, and this is the first of a number of policies that the policy committee will be bringing to your attention. The way this works is we took the currently existing policy, which you can find online. We took this policy, a small task force of counselors who were interested in it, brought their suggestions, and we worked around how can we better improve the quality of instruction to meet their needs. The proposal that you see in front of you is basically what we came up with. It's been through both that task force as well as the policy committee, primarily cleaning up definitions, an increased focus on instructor professional development. The best way that we can improve teaching is that if teachers have both incentive and resources to get better.
I'm going to stop you there because you're starting to lean into debate a little bit. Okay. Any debate on this matter? Councillor Hodgson, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I was just curious if someone could provide some justification for the changes. Just generally, I thought you were going to make a policy and you just moving it. There's some substantive changes, maybe not in ideal, but just in wording, but something to speak to that.
Councillor Graham?
Yeah, I just had some general, I like a question before. I just wonder if someone can explain the last clause of the five and what is psychometrically valid. Cool, because I don't know what that means. And I'm wondering about the mention of interdisciplinarity in number two. That's something that I feel kind of strongly about, and I really like that. Like technology doesn't relate to the objective of the policy because like technology on itself doesn't correlate exactly with like quality of instruction or anything. So it's just a tool. It's not just gonna make instruction better all by itself. But I think that interdisciplinarity is something that really needs to be strongly integrated into teaching. In a lot of ways now it's really tokenistic. But I think that learning of all kinds is interdisciplinary and that if you sector it off, it never really starts with something. And so I'm wondering why. Maybe it's misinterpreting or something, but I'm wondering why that mention of interdisciplinary, like saying it doesn't relate, I'm wondering why that's a thing. So, open questions.
Thank you. Any other debate? Vice President Chong?
I'll take Councillor Hodgson's question. Why are we making changes to this? My understanding is that the purpose of renewing the policies is to take a look at it and say, what could be made better? And that's the sense the policy committee is taking this year. For every policy that we're renewing, we're not just bringing it to council and say, let's do what we've always been doing. We're actually taking a look to see what we think could be made better. So I'm afraid this is just the start of a number of political policies that will come into this improvements. And in response to Mr. Green's questions, so current political policy says that the SU should advocate for an effective teaching evaluation mechanism. I think the concept of effectiveness is really quite vague. Who's to say that our current teaching evaluation mechanism isn't effective? So instead, what we've done is clarify that it can be psychometrically valid, or in other words, actually measures what the questions are trying to assess. So the questions don't include bias. Or don't direct the students answering that in a particular way. In terms of your point around technology and interdisciplinary, don't get me wrong, I think they're important too. The point that we were trying to make is that currently in policy there's a whereas clause that states interdisciplinary exploration and advances in technology influence the quality of education. I totally agree with that, but then there's no be a result clause to follow it up. So like, it's great that we have that principle, but it doesn't translate into any action, any stance, any objectives of the SU in current political policy, and the task force didn't see it as necessary to the current set of objectives of the policy. So I agree with the principle, but in practice.
Thank you, Vice President Lau.
Yeah, wondering if any counselors would, given Vice President Chung's kind of reasoning there, would see it, I guess, in the best interest of the policy then to add a be a result clause rather than take away the whereas clause for interdisciplinary, and that's something that we're passionate about.
A reminder, because I'm not sure where you're sort of leaning with that, that straw polls aren't in order in the Students' Council. However, if, for example, in that scenario, Vice President Lau wished to test the strength, if you will, of that sort of support, he could, of course, make a motion to amend to include that and see whether that motion passed or failed. So that would be one example of a way that you can avoid straw polls in the future. Any further debate? See, Councillor Graham?
I'd like to move amendments.
Okay, Councillor Graham?
Per number two, can I replace the word don't with directly and make the word relate?
So that it would read that the state of technology and interdisciplinarity directly relates to the objectives of the policy?
Yeah.
That's correct. You know what, it's funny, because after I suggested that to Vice President Lau, I'm thinking about this now, and I'm actually going to have to rule that out of order, because it substantially deviates from the original intent of the motion. So apologies to both Councillor Graham and Vice President Lau on that one. That being said, if you did want to test that in the future, you could do one of two things. Number one, you could strike that clause. That would be an acceptable amendment, and or in the future propose another policy change at the next council meeting or whatnot that would include that sort of phrasing. Or you could vote down the entire motion and then re-present one with that different phrasing. Councillor Graham?
Thanks for the clarification. Can I move instead to strike?
Sure. Okay. Yeah, I'll allow that. So to strike point two on the item. Is there a seconder for that amendment? Is that a second? Vice President Lau?
Actual point of information.
Okay. Yeah.
So
point of information.
Point number two.
Yeah.
Does that mean that we will reassess it, or does that just mean that the whereas clause will stay and?
Whereas clauses are a little bit tricky for a couple of reasons. Number one, we don't, at least in practice, has dictated, and please correct me, Councillor Patel, if this is different than how policy committee has been treating it, but practice has typically dictated that directives are included in principles, so typically the be it resolved clauses are what's included in the directive. The whereas clauses are more or less developed by policy committee based on input from the relevant parties or other input based on the expected outcomes from the principles. Whereas clauses, and this is true of anywhere in Robert's Rules, aren't actually sort of part of the policy, if you will. They supplement the policy and they perhaps provide background, but they aren't actually part of the directive. So whether or not that whereas clause would stay is probably more of an editorial decision on policy committee's part, to be honest. And if the opposite, as I was saying to Councillor Graham, wish to be included, then we could bring forward another motion that would present that as a principle that we would then focus on that. And if that's the case, then policy would again have a conversation on the appropriate whereas clauses with that. Councillor Battelle, does that more or less summarize Paul? Okay, thank you. So do we have a seconder for the amendment? Seeing none, that amendment dies. So we are back to the main motion. Any further debate, Councillor Mohammed? Sorry? Call the question? Okay, I do see some more faces, so I'll allow the call to question. If I don't see anyone else with a placard go up and I'm at the end of my speakers list, I just don't do the call to question because it takes more time than just having the vote. But since there are people that want to speak, I'll allow the call to question. So, motion to call the question, is there a seconder for that motion? Seeing no seconder, that motion dies. So we will continue debate. Councillor Speakman and someone else at their placard. Okay, Councillor Vitale on a point of parliamentary inquiry. If this were to have been struck, and obviously that motion didn't take place, but if this were to be struck, it's a little bit strange because it's a negative directive, which would suggest that that sort of couldn't happen in the policy. Because there's no sort of positive reinforcement, it would be out of it wouldn't be germane for a policy committee to sort of arbitrarily insert that in the policy if that's not the intent of the principal. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. And by the way, because a couple of these have come up, I think I mentioned before, but if you have a point of parliamentary inquiry, you can't interrupt other people when they're speaking, but when I'm within between speaking terms and I'm just going on ranting as I usually do, you can just pop up and say point to parliamentary inquiry. Councillor Speakman, thank you very much. You're giving me great examples of your question. Go ahead.
Are we allowed to make amendments to the policy itself in this, or is it only amendments to the motion?
We can only make amendments to principles. Let me backtrack for a little bit. This is a first reading of a policy, so we can only ever deal with principles in first reading. You can't say, I want to remove this specific word in this policy, or I want to add this specific phrase in the policy, or something like that. It's the same as first reading with bylaws. That's just not allowed in first reading of policy. So we're always dealing with principles. Now you can amend the principles that are presented to policy committee that would then draft the specific wording based on the principles that were approved. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so right now we're just approving these principles and it will be presented with this quality instruction policy again later?
That's correct. And because it's suggesting a change, it means there's an existing policy, and so some of the principles are sort of somewhat more leading perhaps than with a brand new policy where it's sort of suggesting we're no longer going to do this, and so chances are that clause is going to get struck from policy committee. It would be out of line for the policy, the first reading principles, to say strike this clause from the policy, and part of the reason for that is it's policy committee's task to ensure that would cover it entirely. Maybe there's another section of the policy that would have to be changed to sort of reflect that change or something like that. So that's first reading. Any other debate? Seeing none, we will call to vote. All those in favor of item 6A, any opposed? That motion carries and will be referred to the policy committee. With that, we have now dealt with an item of business and we've been in session for more than 90 minutes, so we will take a 15-minute recess. I'm going to make it 14 to make it nice and round, so we will reconvene at 8:45. Oh, I was going to say that was really loud, but it was like on the glass as well, so sorry about that, folks. That's better. Okay, folks, we're going to call this meeting back to order. We still have plenty of items on our order paper, so I want to get back on track right away here. So we're going to move on to item 7A. Grahan moves to appoint one member of Students' Council to Bylaw Committee. Do we have a seconder for that motion? Thank you, Councillor. Yes, Councillor Grahan?
I admit it to you.
Yes. Can I tell you what? Let's introduce it first, and then we'll introduce an amendment. And for reference, in terms of how that would work, the mover of the motion is the owner, if you will, of the motion until it's been read. So since I just read it, now Eric can't change it on the fly. If he'd have done it 1 minute earlier, he could have changed it as he'd like. So, weird procedural thing, but now it sort of belongs to the assembly, and so he could either make an amendment, or he could, in fact, I'm going to do this properly, and he asked if he could change the... Now let's do an amendment instead. If he was going to withdraw it at this point, he would need the consent of the assembly, so basically the consent of everyone. But since he's looking to an amendment, we'll just do a standard amendment thing. So we will have a seconder first. I saw Councillor Nguyen up there. Councillor Graham to introduce.
Yeah. Do members of the bylaw committee who have increasing number of commitments to like more task forces being created that just need two people to join bylaw committee? It's super fun. The time commitment is like an hour to an hour and a half every 2 weeks. I brought pizza last meeting. What we're discussing over the next little while is our conflict of interest bylaw and potentially getting rid of GIC elections. So, like, fancy, complicated, interesting stuff. So, yeah, join bylaw.
And with that, I think Councillor Graham probably has an amendment he wants to make to change 1 to 2. Is that correct?
Yeah.
All right. Is there any objection to carrying that amendment as friendly? Seeing no objection, we will do that. And since this is a nomination, we will do our typical nomination process. So we're now nominating two members of council. So I will open the floor to nominations. Not all at once, everybody. Councillor Bannister?
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
What day do you meet on?
Sorry
if you're...
Councilor Graham? Go ahead.
We meet on Mondays right now.
Okay. Opening the floor to nominations. Councilor Speakman.
I nominate Councilor Binchik.
Councilor Binchik, do you accept?
I do.
Do you accept? Okay. Further nominations. Councilor Hodgson.
I nominate Councilor Hanwell.
Councillor Hanwell, do you accept?
I respectfully decline.
Okay, Councillor Graham?
I'd like to nominate Councillor Muhammad.
Councillor Muhammad, do you accept?
I accept.
Any further nominations?
No.
Seeing no further nominations, we will close nominations. Congratulations to Councillors Binchik and Muhammad. With that, we will move on to item 7B. Woods moves to appoint 6 members, I believe that's supposed to be, of Students' Council to the Post-Secondary Learning Act Task Force. Do we have a seconder for that motion? Thank you, Councillor Douglas. Vice President Woods to introduce.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. As Council hopefully is aware, the previous meeting, we passed the Terms of Reference to create a Post-Secondary Learning Act Task Force, the aim of which is to do a line-by-line review of the PSLA in order to edit it based on from a student perspective. It will be the document that we use when lobbying on this issue internally with CAUSE as well as with the provincial government on the changes we feel should be within the PSLA. Meetings will likely occur Thursday evening or Wednesday evening, one of the two, more likely Thursday by the sounds of it at this point. They will be likely running weekly at this point. However, obviously, your time commitment, it's hard to make a meeting every week, so that won't necessarily be enforced. That being said, it's incredibly important that we finish this by the end of August.
Thank you. Before we open nominations, any questions for Vice President Woods? Seeing none, we will open the floor to nominations. We have 6 openings. Councillor Hodgson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd like to nominate myself.
I assume you accept. Councillor Borden. Councillor Hanwell. Okay. Do I see Vice President Lay up there first, or no? Councillor Speakman.
I'd like to nominate Councillor Grokey.
Councillor Grokey.
I accept.
President Kuzmu.
I'd like to nominate Councillor Muhammad.
Councillor Muhammad, do you accept?
Yes.
He beat you to it. Councillor Douglas?
I'd like to nominate myself.
Okay. Councillor Hanwell?
I'd like to nominate Councillor Borden.
Councillor Borden, do you accept? Any additional nominations? There are currently 6. That being said, I would still encourage no more nominations if there are any others. Any further nominations? Seeing no further nominations, we will... Oh! Councillor Valdez, thank you.
I'd like to nominate Councillor Zhang.
Councillor Zhang, do you accept? Okay. Any further nominations? Seeing no further nominations, we will close nominations. Congratulations to Councillors Hodgson, Hanwell, Grookey, Mohammed, Douglas, and Borden. Congratulations to Vice President Whip for now having a functioning committee with quorum. Moving on, as mentioned, item 7C, in sight of Vice President Lay.
Was on membership. Did the speaker verify whether they fall under the membership as outlined in... Oh, sorry, I'm looking for one.
I assume you're withdrawing your point of... Actually, that would be a point of order. But yeah. Okay. With that, we are moving on. Item 7C and item 7D were both withdrawn. So we'll move to item 7E. Hodgson moves to create the dedicated fee unit review task force based on the attached terms of reference, and the document is attached. Do we have a seconder for that motion? Councillor Graham, thank you very much. Before we go into this in too much... Oh, no, we already have a task force. I was going to explain what a task force does, but I think we know. If you have any questions, rise on a point of parliamentary inquiry. Barring that, Councillor Hodgson to introduce...
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So this came out. I sent out an email to all of council who read it. I tried to kind of outline why I would like to create this task force. It's a pretty big issue, so it's kind of hard to outline all the issues surrounding it. For example, I brought this to audit committee and gave them like 7 or 8 documents of documentation, so like 30 pages or something like that. But so it's kind of hard to outline everything, but like I said in my email, this is essentially the reason I re-ran for council, is to address the things that hopefully this task force will be able to address. Specifically, there were a couple issues that came about last year with how bylaw 3000 is structured. There's a lot of unclarity surrounding DFUs and our bylaws. Currently, it's silent on a lot of things. So just to go through the scope really quickly, the 4 things I would like to see the task force do is just examine how other student associations collect fees, basically. So we do it one way. There's SUs across Canada that have different structures. Is my understanding they have quite a unique structure, actually, in how our fee system is structured. Review the categories of fees. Currently, there's several classifications of fees, determine discrepancies, risks, and ambiguities within SU bylaw. Since there's a lot of areas in bylaws that are silent on how our DFU should operate, or not operate, but how they exist, basically. It's not clearly defined. As well as review and formalize audit financial review standards. And in my opinion, the audit standards across the...
I'm going to cut you off during an introduction when it begins with, in my opinion. But you may proceed if you have anything else to say for introduction.
No, just to formalize basically how we audit the DMVs.
Okay, thank you. Any debate on this particular item? Councillor Graham?
I have an open question. So, under membership, it says 2 representatives from different dedicated fee organizations. I'm just a little curious about that because I'm just wondering how some DFUs would have representation and other ones wouldn't. And like, how would that be chosen and is that fair? I'm just curious about how that would be managed. Someone with your answer.
Thank you. Further debate, Councillor Hodgson?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So I'll try to address that. Initially, I had a fairly complicated selection process that I don't think would have worked. It was council creates a selection committee that would then select DFU applicants. I think this was a way it's much simpler. Essentially, what I was planning on doing is emailing the primary contact with all DFU representatives, so either the chair of their board or someone equivalent to the chief editor, the gateway, that kind of thing. So, and for them to select among them 2 representatives. interest between all the of you should align more or less. Like, some groups will have specific interests over others. It's important for their representatives to bring these interests to the table and relying on the GFUs to coordinate this effort forward to make sure the representatives are bringing their issues to the committee. I wanted to just keep the number of people on the committee down so that we can meet effectively. I would hope that DFUs would communicate their concerns and issues to the representatives to bring up at the committee, or the task force, sorry.
Thank you. Any further debate? Councillor Green?
Would the task force meetings be open to the public or for other DFUs to attend if they so wish, even if they weren't selected as representatives by whatever means?
And perhaps, just because this is a useful time to do it, and I'm not sure if we've talked about this, to give slightly to Councillor Graham's point, there is a bylaw that the SU has, bylaw 500, which details access to information in meetings and so on, and it talks about when things would and would not be public and how things are classified as confidential. And I don't want to go through the entire thing, but typically speaking, most things that the Students' Union does, whether that's meetings or minutes or documents or whatnot, are open unless they meet a certain criteria, so things like relates to employment or personal information, compromise legal positions and that sort of thing. So that is perhaps a good starting point to slightly answer Councillor Graham's question. However, of course, the floor is open to debate, and anyone feel free to try and answer that question or debate with it or whatnot. Any further debate? Councillor Hodgson?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and I'll just kind of echo your comments there. Yeah, they'll absolutely be open unless we are ever discussing something that would need to be moved in camera, like legal opinion or employment things, which I highly doubt. I don't know if there could be, but other than that, this would just comprise the voting membership. So anyone else would obviously be more than welcome to attend.
Any further debate? Councillor Minarski.
I just have a question. Maybe somebody can answer. I was wondering if there's any safeguards in place to ensure that the two representatives from DFUs that they represent accurately all DFUs and not just their own, so that there's some conflict of interest.
Any further debate? Councillor Douglas?
Yeah, I cede my time to Councillor Gray.
Absolutely.
Someone can correct me on this, but as far as I know, the SU has already gotten at least one, possibly multiple, like professional legal opinions on the status of our DFUs. So I think that is probably an issue that would come up in this task force. The possibility of the discussions happening in this task force being like considered confidential or whatever under that bylaw that was mentioned earlier, I think is like probably substantial. And so I guess the limited representation of DFUs on this task force is pretty concerning to me. And I guess, yeah, just to echo Councillor Minarski's comment about if there is just like a highly selective like two people, and how I just don't see that as being entirely fair to ensure that all the DFUs have adequate like representation on this task force. I personally disagree that a lot of their interests overlap in my experience.
Thank you. Councillor Valdez?
I would like to defer my secretary to Councillor Hodgson.
Councillor Hodgson?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So just to address Councillor Lenarski's point, I think the obviously everything coming out of this task force will be public. They'll present recommendations to council that will be available to everyone to see, DFUs included, and included in the agenda when it comes forward. To speak to the point about and as well, I would again highly encourage the DFU representatives to be actively soliciting DFU interest. I mean, that's if I was to be a representative on this task force, that's what I would be doing as a representative. It's my job to represent council's interests, not just my own on this task force. So I would highly encourage the DFU representatives to do that as well. To speak to the point about, I don't quite know how, not every DFU has a representative on this committee, but if they were to, there would be seven or eight is the number of DFUs we have, and I don't see how a committee that size could effectively meet or discuss these issues. So I've done what I think is most appropriate by having roughly equal representation, two members from council, two members from DFU, someone from audit committee has an entirely different perspective on this issue, and the SU vice president of operations chair, as this sort of falls under his portfolio.
Further debate, Vice President Lay.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd like to speak in favor of this motion. I think with the DFU review, would be something useful for council on this meeting to firm their stance on, because it's always the responsible practice to review how student money is being used. And in terms of the DFU concern, all DFUs, I guess, first thing they'll choose within themselves to elect their representatives, also because it is an open conversation or open meeting. The DFU, the non-voting DFU members would be able to still attend and get their voices if their concerns about not having their specific interest in place. But I would argue that all DFUs have a common line of interest.
Thank you. Councillor Patel? Towards you, so you can feel free to take it or disregard it.
Would you be able to outline what is the main purpose of your
statement? I think because I'm not familiar with all of them, but I feel that they just work in different areas and they have different visions, that would make their business a little bit different from one another. And I'm sure there's a lot that they align on, but there's definitely some differences there.
Any further debate, Councillor Douglas?
Not a further Councillor Graham.
Councillor Graham.
In terms of DFUs having equivalent interests, I mean, the point is that I don't think it's possible. I being on the board of AFERD, which is a DFU, I have no idea what the interests of the Gateway are, or what the interests of Wisk are, what the interests of Golden Barrels kind of like they said or whatever. So I mean, just because DFUs are basically super autonomous, so I mean it's hard to say that we have equivalent interests, because I like being on the board of the DFU, I have no idea what the interests of other DFUs are, so I can't say that they're equivalent in my own personal experience at least. And so right now I'd be considering an amendment to say at most one representative from the different DFU units if they so wish to have one or something to that effect. So, I mean, I wouldn't impose mandatory representation or whatever, but I mean, it's different because the point that Councillor Hodgson raised earlier is that he has an obligation to represent all of council, whereas these so-called representatives of DFUs have no legal or like social or any kind of obligation to represent other DFUs. And just given the uncertainty and ambiguity around like whatever their common interests are, even if those exist, that it's hard to, I don't think it's fair to assume that at all. So that is a amendment that I might be moving later on.
You are free to move an amendment. You are free to make a motion at the end of your speaking turn. So would you?
Sure.
Okay. So you care to make an amendment? Could you again clarify now once I have the paperwork in front of me? Okay. Go ahead. What you wish to amend?
I'd like to amend the one bullet point that says two representatives from different DFU unit organizations,
yeah,
and replace it with at most one representative from every DFU organization if they wish to have a representative. You can correct my grammar or whatever.
No, I don't want to editorialize too much, but the last part about if they wish to may not be necessary, it's entirely your call. Okay. So at most, because at most sort of covers it. So to strike the words two representatives from different DFU or dedicated fee unit organizations and replace with at most one representative from every dedicated, actually each is probably a better word there, from each dedicated fee unit organization. Is everyone clear on what the proposed amendment is? Okay, do we have a seconder for that amendment? Councillor Mohammed, thank you very much. I guess you've spoken about it already, but Councillor Graham, do you care to introduce the amendment any more?
No, I think I've said what I want to do.
Okay, any debate on the amendment? Councillor Hodgson?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So I'm going to speak against this amendment. First and foremost, it raises the membership of the committee from 6 to 11. Which is pretty substantive, and I don't see how we could ever really effectively meet with an 11-person task force. Everyone here is on an expanding committee. They generally have 6 to 7 members. Small numbers make it easier to schedule meetings. Any chair in this room already knows how hard it is to schedule a meeting sometimes. Meeting with 11 people bi-weekly for the next 6 months, I find would be very, very, very difficult. That was my reasoning for keeping it. Yeah, I would like to have representation all across the board and get everyone's opinion, but realistically, this will not result in having an effective meeting schedule. Secondly, I disagree that the DFUs are that different. Yes, each DFU represents a very different cause, a very different interest, but in how they operate within SU bylaw, there is no distinction. Bylaw 3000 says DFUs. That is one of the things this task force specifically would like to address. I think the difference between different DFUs is being played. SU bylaw does not distinguish. The only place it does distinguish is in their mandate statements in Bylaw 6000. If we were to look at something like that, obviously I would want to consult with each DFU individually on what they think about their mandate statement. Again, I think two representatives is enough. They can solicit feedback from the DFUs. It's the same as, and I would encourage in this process when the DFU representatives elect, or the DFUs elect their representatives, they'll know who they are. They know who to bring their interest to and why. They don't think they're doing an adequate job representing their interests. They should remove them. I don't feel that we really need the, yeah, we get an advantage of everyone's represented, but the committee will never meet effectively, and so it's essentially pointless.
Councillor Valdez?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Speaker. So I just want to echo what Councillor Washington has to say. They're not going to meet effectively, and it's going to be hard to get these through with 11 people. It's performed with 50 plus 1. So, I mean, like, that's realistically, it's not going to happen. And just with council representation and DFU representation, 7 and 3 that I'm looking at right now, there's not equal representation from council either. So I'm against this.
What about the rhetoric?
Councillor Graham?
So since we're discussing amendment, I'm going to make a motion. Does that mean I get two?
Yes, you get two more speaking turns. That being said, once we leave the amendment and go back to the main motion, you don't get another two for the main motion,
right,
so to speak. But yes, you have two speaking turns for this motion. Councillor Nguyen.
One question.
There's a motion to call to question. Do we have a seconder for that? Councillor Grokey, thank you very much. So again, this is calling the amendment to question, not the actual main motion. All those in favour of calling the amendment to question? Any opposed? Okay, that motion is carried. So again, the amendment is to strike the line two representatives from different DFU organizations in their membership and replace with at most one representative from each dedicated B unit organization. All those in favor of the amendment? All those opposed? That motion fails. We are back to debate on the main amendment. And before we resume debate on the main amendment, I just wanted to bring up the point because we've had a couple of sponsors to cover people who have run out of speaking turns, if you will. Another avenue that's always available to council, not that you have to take this route, because the sort of sponsor or deferring speaking turns to others is perfectly legitimate, is to move into what's called informal consideration, which is basically the exact same sort of debate, except there is no limit on speaking turns. But that's no speaking turns for anyone, so anyone could conceivably debate as long as wanted until we either exhausted the list or a motion to call the question passed. So I believe Councillor Douglas was still on my... were you on my speaker's list from last time? No? Okay. Any further debate on the main motion? Seeing no further debate...
Can I defer my
time? You can... So Councillor Speakman with a deferral to... Councillor Graham?
Okay, so even if... people think that, like, having all these DFU representatives, like, too many is unfeasible. I'm still, like, really unclear about how they'll be selected, and I think there's some misunderstanding in council about, like, what DFU still actually are or whatever, which is understandable. But, like, there are autonomous organizations which don't have any formal collective interests. So, I mean, I don't think it's possible to say that, like, they will just elect representatives amongst themselves, or if they don't like what those representatives are, then they'll just replace them, because those structures don't exist at all, and there's no way to, like, I mean, it would just be, like, be informal, I mean, and there would be no way to, like, remove someone or anything, so, I mean, the structure of representation or whatever between these DFUs doesn't exist. I mean, in my experience, like, there isn't that many ties. So it's strange to... It's basically, like, just referring to, like, structures of representation that don't actually exist between DFUs, which is really confusing. So, I mean, even if we only wanted to limit it to two representatives from different DFU organizations, then it's still really unclear to me how that would happen. It would end up just being really divisive. Between DFUs of, like, who would actually get that kind of representation. And on a final note, speaking from experience, even if every DFU was allowed to have representation, I can pretty much guarantee that not all of them would take up the opportunity. So, I mean, I don't think that these, like, issues around increasing quorum and, like, difficulties of scheduling is that big of a deal, but that's kind of a moot point. So, whatever.
Any further... Councillor Nguyen.
Call the question.
Okay, it's a motion to call the question. Any further debate? Seeing no further debate, I'll just go straight to the motion. So, item 7E, Hodgson moves to create the DFU task force, the review task force based on the attached terms of reference. All those in favour of item 7E? All those opposed? That motion carries. And because of that, item 7F is in order, so we'll move to item 7F. Hodgson moves to appoint two members to the newly created DFU Review Task Force. Do we have a seconder for that? Councillor Bannister, thank you very much. Councillor Hodgson to introduce.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So this is exactly to appoint the two provincial councillors to the task force we just passed. We will be meeting bi-weekly, as stated in the terms of reference. As for the date, I have no idea. Time commitment, an hour or two, twice a week. There will probably be some additional meeting as well. We'll know more once we actually get this up and running.
Any, or sorry, not any debate. This is a.
Point of conversation.
Yes, Councillor Patel.
Is it appropriate for councillors that are already SU representatives on the MPU to set up this task force?
In the sense of, like, if you are already on another DFU board, let me just consult Bylaw 100 to make sure that there's no... I don't believe there's any violation of the conflict of interest section, but I'm just going to do a quick read over it to make sure. Just stand by. Okay, so just looking up section Bylaw 100, section 19, folks. So there's a couple parts that that are quasi relevant, and I just want to work through it here. So in particular, section 19.4 that reads: No member of Students' Council shall vote on a motion relating to a student group or organization which means he/she is a member, unless that organization is a faculty association. Membership of, on an organization shall be defined as regular meeting attendance and voting or speaking privileges at meetings or holding office within that organization. That applies to Students' Council. There's no mention in here of any of Students' Council delegated authorities or standing committees, task forces, etc. So I see no impediment to someone sitting on both. And in fact, it's not completely clear to me, and maybe this is a question for Bylaw Committee to clarify, whether or not duly appointed members of an organization from an appointment made by Students' Council might apply or might not apply. And I believe Bylaw Committee is looking at this section, so they may want to take a look at that to clarify what the intent of that is. So, but to answer your question, no, I don't see any block, any impediment there. So with that, we will open the floor to nominations. Sorry, are there any further questions before we do nominations? Seeing none, okay. Open the floor to nominations. Councillor Greenhead?
I'd like to nominate Councillor Patel.
Councillor Patel, do you accept? Thank you. Okay, Councillor Hodgson?
I'd like to nominate myself.
And you accept, obviously. Councillor Zhang?
I'd like to nominate myself.
Councillor Minarski, did you have your... You're good? Okay. Any further nominations, Councillor? Sorry?
Point of parliamentary.
Yes.
I'm just wondering, out of curiosity, are we appointing people from Students' Council right now?
Yes. Yes. This would be from Students' Council, because the appointment from Audit Committee members would happen at Audit Committee. So. Councillor Bannister?
I would like to nominate Councillor Graham.
Councillor Graham, do you accept?
I'll have to debate respectfully the client, because it would be a conflict of interest.
Okay.
Okay.
Any further nominations? Councillor Valdez?
I'd like to nominate Councillor Bannister.
Councillor Bannister, do you accept?
I respectfully decline.
Any further nominations? Councillor Bernarski?
I'd like to nominate Councillor Speakman.
Councillor Speakman, do you accept?
I regretfully decline.
Any further nominations? Vice President Lay?
Wait, can I... Sorry. is this one of the task force that's going to be done by the end of August? Or how it's ongoing? Okay, then can I retract my...
Sure. I take it you accept then?
Yeah.
Okay, Councillor Speakman accepts. Thank you very much. Vice President Lay? You good? Any further nominations? Seeing no further nominations and none online, nope, we will close nominations. So we have two spots and we have four names: Councillors Patel, Hodgson, Zhang, and Speakman. So we will do our typical, you get 30 seconds and I'll cut you off very tightly. In fact, I'll hang on a sec here, I'll actually give you a countdown so then. Oops, so it's a little easier for you to see. There we go. Okay, so you'll get exactly 30 seconds to give your spiel, and then everyone will have up to two votes to use. So we will go down the list in the order it came. So, Councillor Patel.
Thank you for nominating me, first of all. I have an interest in DFU, so I sit on the board, and I think I have more knowledge
Thank you. Councilor Hodgson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Like I've said a couple times now, this is essentially the reason I ran for council. It's an issue I'm quite passionate about. It came up at about the end of my term last year. I also am the representative on both the FACRA's and the Gateways Board, FACRA's CJSR. So I have a good working knowledge of DFUs and how they operate, as well as pretty open.
Sorry. Councillor Zhang.
Yeah, so I stand by the fact that I've spoken to half a task force that reviews how our dedicated views are allocated, and that also how the time of
availability. Good. Okay. Councillor Speakman.
On third thought, I'm probably not the most suitable person for this dedicated. Like, thinking about money just makes me cringe, and I was talking to my dad about my taxes the other night. I almost died. Someone said you should vote for Councillor Vitale.
I'm going to have to stop you there. Unfortunately, I don't want to get into sort of debate on this, but I will remove your name from the list if you would like. Okay, so we now have three names, Councillor Vitale, Councillor Hodgson, and Councillor Zhang. Two positions, the good old... Oh. Hang on 1 second here. Okay. Okay, so Kelsey, I got your vote just so that you know in case you're looking. And we'll do the good old, if you would put your heads down and raise your placards if you have them, or if not, put your hands up fairly high. Councillor Speakman?
Yeah, sorry. Since there's also going to be a member from... audit committee, that would be a different position, right?
That's correct.
And that will be selected
by audit committee.
Audit committee?
Yeah.
Can we go over the members of audit committee real quick?
I'm not sure that's really germane to the debate. I know where you're going, but it's not necessarily germane because I don't want to speculate as to where audit committee would vote on membership. So.
Okay.
So if you wouldn't mind putting your heads down, and our guests, if you wouldn't mind doing that too, just so we can keep this nice and private. So again, members of council, you get two votes each. So I will go in the order we went. Councillor Vitale, if you'd like to vote for Councillor Vitale, raise your placard. If you guys could raise them sort of all the way up or put them all the way down, there's some of you that are sort of middle of the pack here. So, Councillor Vitale, still. Thank you. Placards down. Councillor Hodgson. Thank you. And Councillor Zhang. Thank you. Placards down. You can put your heads up. Congratulations to Councillors Vitale and Hodgson. With that, we move on to item 7G. Mohammed Kelly moved that Students' Council approve a new political policy in first reading based on the following principles. The Students' Union, SU, lobby the University Administration to adopt a similar stance as King's University College by committing to treat any application made by Omar Ahmed Khader as any other. The Students' Union, assisting Omar Ahmed Khader in his integration into the University of Alberta by ensuring that all SU spaces will be free from discrimination and by condemning any discrimination that potentially occurs. And the Students' Union encouraging other post-secondary institutions to adopt similar stances so that Omar Ahmed Khader has other options when receiving his post-education. With that, Councillor Mohammed to introduce.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I would like you both thank you for allowing me to table this motion. I would also like to welcome fellow concerned students who came here to support this motion. If you could raise your hands, that'd be great. There's seven of them here, there were eight. And we have the president of the MSA, and you would also notice they have letters. Oh, we also have a medical resident, and Mona, who actually met Omar twice personally in the prison. So essentially, this political policies is an extension of the presentation that we had last week. The crux of what it does is it ensures that when Mercado receives a basic right to an education. I don't want to creep into the debate too much here, but for just some information items, on the fourth page of your order papers, you'll see that there will be sections of legislation that I'll be citing throughout my speaking terms. So this will just make it easier for you to follow along with me. And yeah, that's the introduction. Also, I'd like to acknowledge that some of the attendees are asking at the moment. So thank you for sticking it out. That's
it. Okay, thank you. Any debate? Councillor Mohammed.
Yeah, so essentially this motion is an exception for the presentation I did, and thereby I hope not to spend much time bogged down in Omar's background. Now we have something crucial from this. At the core of this motion is the idea of preventing discrimination. As a young Somali, I've seen that discrimination occurs on a common basis, and it's no secret that it still occurs in our society, especially on the university campus. For this very reason, I have major sympathy for Omar. I could see myself in his very position. I came to Canada as a result of the Somali Civil War. I could have been brainwashed at a young age. I could have been forced to pick up a gun as a child soldier. But despite his rough imprisonment in Guantanamo Bay, Omar is a lot like us, an eager student who just wants to help the world. So why adopt a policy just on Omar? Well, for a few reasons. One, Omar has been denied his right, his fundamental right to have an education. And two, it's our moral obligation to honor that right. This motion will ensure that the SU pressures the university administration to treat Omar's application like any other student. Now, last week, counselors raised a crucial point, and that was that Omar's application would already be treated like any other application if he applies anyways, or that we should wait until he applied before taking action. To address this point, I emailed the code registrar and I received a reply. And it actually directed me to a section in the university admission policy that's labeled refusal of admission for reasons of danger. Now, it was too late for me to put this in the late editions, but I sent it out in email. But below are two excerpts. The first one is as follows. The university reserves the right to admit applicants on a conditional basis or to refuse admission to an applicant who may constitute a danger or risk to university students, staff, or property, or to persons or property in the wider community. From our presentation last week, we see that there's quite a lot of misinformation about Omar Khadr. Many people still see him as a danger, including the Minister of Public Safety. And we all know that he's just someone who wants to go about and receive his education. Those who know him well, such as Dr. Zink, his current instructor, can attest to the fact that he poses no risk to students on campus and that he would integrate extremely well. Now, the second excerpt is especially crucial. It states that the dean or registrar may refuse admission to an applicant or may make admission subject to whatever conditions the dean or registrar deems necessary. The decision of the dean or registrar will be final and binding. So this essentially states that they can put whatever condition on Omar the second he applies. And an example could be having him report to campus security daily or something more extreme. The purpose of this motion is to assure that this does not happen and that he is treated like any other student. So why is it important that we do this now? It's because we have to keep in mind that based on this section of the admission policy, the decision made upon admission is final and binding, which means that it cannot be changed. So if they make the decision and he becomes an undergrad student at the U of A, it will be already too late to enact policy on this. He would already be discriminated against by the university administration. And since it's binding, there will be no way to remove that discrimination. So this motion has a purpose. It's not an anti-statement, and if adopted, it will fulfill our moral obligation to Mr. Omar Khadr by ensuring that he receives an education. And that's my first point.
Okay. Thank you very much. President Kuzma?
I'll just go after.
Sorry?
I'll go after.
Okay. Councillor Redman?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This motion is very specific to one individual. I was just wondering if a policy could be written in a way where we advocate for all students who are of good standing and not a danger to the public to be able to attend the UVA rather than just a specific individual, because I feel like if this case ever came up again, we could go back to that policy rather than just having one person's name in the student's municipal policies.
Point of information?
I just have a... Point of parliamentary inquiry?
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, Councilor Mohammed.
So if someone defers their speaking time to me, can I defer that speaking time to someone else?
Yeah. You were finished your speaking turn? Okay, I just want to make sure. Now, in doing so, the clock is sort of still ticking, if you will. Like, if the first person uses 1 minute and the second person uses another minute, there's only 4 minutes left then, not the whole 6 minutes sort of thing.
Okay.
So, with that, Councillor Hodgson? Councillor Hodgson?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Speaker. So, I'm going to have to speak against this motion. I'll be 100% honest, this is something I'm actually pretty torn about. This is, I 100% sympathize with what's happened. It's something I've followed since I was 16 or 15 and read everything I could find about it. Watched the documentary that Councillor Mohammed mentioned in the previous presentation, but I don't feel it falls under our purview as students' councils and representatives of the students' union. You've mentioned specifically this admissions policy that the university has. I feel it's not good practice to preemptively say, well, maybe the university might deny him admission if he was ever to apply. We don't know. I have no idea how he'll be treated. I know he has to serve so many more years in jail, and when he gets out, I don't know if he can go to jail or go to university while incarcerated. That was a point that was raised last time that I still haven't had answers, so that's something I would like to know more about. But I really see no reason necessary when he's paid. If he has served his time, which I'm not at all implying it's just that he does, I really disagree, but if he has served his time, I don't see any reason why the university wouldn't see him as any other citizen. I'm sure there's lots of people who have gone to jail and turned their lives around and gotten an education after. I mean, I just don't see the reasoning in kind of preemptively saying this might happen. As well, I would like to know more information about why the university has this policy in place. Like, they actually have it, but I'm going to assume that they have it for a reason. I would like to hear at least the university's justification for having this policy before we start advocating against it and for its removal.
Thank you. Just looking at the time and in the interest of time and to ensure that we can deal with this before we're forced out of this room, I'm going to limit speaking turns to 3 minutes. With that, Councillor Battelle.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I would like to speak in favor of this policy, but not the way it is right now. As chair of the policy committee, I think I can speak for the policy committee and say that we have a lot of questions and we would like to scrutinize this a little bit more. And we have more opportunity during policy committee meetings to go in depth and answer all the questions that other councillors have. This has not been forwarded to the policy committee yet, so that's kind of the point to answer one of the councillors' questions. So I don't know if this is appropriate or not, but I would like to ask to move this to the policy committee to take a better look at it and answer all the questions that we can possibly answer about it.
You want to make that motion?
I can do that.
You can make a motion, I'm just going to get the precise phrasing, but you can move to refer it to a committee for recommendation, yes. Just make sure I have the right phrase. Yeah, no, so you can make a motion. It is called refer to committee, so you can move to refer the motion to policy committee, if you will. And just because we typically would do this on, if you guys will give me 30 seconds, normally this would be done on something that came from the committee, and so when you send it back, it's sort of a look at it again and bring it back to us. So I just want to make a confirmation as to how that scenario would go if it was sort of referred on its own accord back to... Just give me 1 second. Okay. So it looks like if we did move to refer, and I'm going to double check one more section here, that policy committee would indeed be expected to come back with something for council to vote on. So Councillor Patel is making a motion to refer this to the policy committee, I'm assuming. So if that were to be done, then policy committee would be required to meet and basically discuss the matter and to bring it back to Students' Council. You can also attach, and you may want to, with this... given that this is a first reading, and so it's perhaps unclear why you're referring to them, it can be referred to a committee with instructions. For example, we want you to look at this, or we want you to look at that, or that sort of thing, and then brought back that way. But either way, policy committee would be expected to return it to council as some sort of a recommended policy, either as it stands now or as an amended policy. So is everyone clear on that? Would that be a point of parliamentary inquiry? Or?
Yeah. So is this motion debatable?
I believe it is. A motion to refer to a committee is debatable and is amendable and requires a majority vote. So, a motion to refer to a committee, do we have a second? Before we ask for a seconder, is there any instruction or anything you would wish to attach to that motion, Councillor Patel, or simply refer?
I guess we can attach a motion to refer principles or something to get the policy committee to ask council for questions and address those questions during policy committee.
Okay, it's fairly general, so if you want to do that, maybe we'll just leave it at the basic referral then. So do we have a seconder for the motion to refer? Councillor Kruelke. Councillor Patel to introduce.
I pretty much said it, but I think that there's a lot of questions that need to be answered, and if we are going to pass the policy, I think it should be done right, and we are unclear about all the logistics around...
I'm going to stop you there, because you're starting to get into debate, so... Is that a point of parliamentary inquiry?
In policy committee, while we have this, if this was brought to policy committee, how much of the ideals behind it can be changed for the same policy to come back? So, for example, before I stated that we get a general thing, would that be too far from the original policy for it to be brought back?
I would think that the same, more or less the same standard would apply as sort of a motion to amend in council, and since this came up earlier, I'm also, I'm going to be flipping through this book a lot tonight, but I'm going to read, because I know there's a phrase that deals with this in the motion to amend, and it might give a little bit of clarification as to what is sort of appropriate.
So I guess, would we just have this forwarded to us, and we have to amend this, what we have right here?
Yeah, so what would happen is, this would go to policy committee. Policy committee would be expected to discuss the principles, and then vote on either these principles to recommend to council, or some sort of amended principles or something like that to council, and then it would come back to council as a first reading still, and then council would be free to vote on first reading, and then if that passed, it would go back to policy for drafting a second reading. But I just want to get the phrasing, because there actually is a really good phrasing of amendment that talks about it. So if you bear with me for 30 seconds. There we go. So Robert's rules, reading on it, is an amendment must always be germane, that is, closely related to or having bearing on the subject of the motion to be amended. This means that no new subject can be introduced under pretext of being an amendment. Because if for your example there specifically, because if you were to change it to something like a general and not specific to a person, if the principles were the same in the sense that it would still do the same things or advocate in the same way as this would be, I would see that as still applying to sort of the original principles because it would also affect that individual, and so I would probably permit that. So, with that, I believe we have, yes, Councillor Grookey, I believe, seconded it. Somebody seconded it. Is that Councillor Bannister? No, Councillor Grookey? Okay, good. So we have a seconder. We had an introduction. So any debate on the motion to refer to committee? Councillor Muhammad?
Yeah, I would just like to say it's extremely unnecessary to send this to policy committee. Any questions that are had on committees, first principles can be asked during the debate. That's what the debate is for. And also, it is not legislation. It's not in the bylaw to send a policy, to send a potential policy to policy committee. It is practice. I find it, that would be the debate. Sorry.
You can debate. Okay. As long as the debate is germane to the amendment. Or sorry, not the amendment, to the motion to refer. Yeah, you're not an instruction, so you can debate.
I find it frustrating to cut the first principles. To cut this debate within the first few speaking terms, it just takes away the spirit of debate. And it takes away the autonomy of the counselor to take action on an issue that he is very passionate about. I believe that we should go ahead, ask these questions during the debate. And just find a way to work around this. I didn't really expect this to happen, this to come up so quickly. I expected at least some chance for us to delve into what is the mandate of the SU before we went into, deferring it to policy. Maybe we could have this motion later on in the debate. It's just extremely unnecessary and extremely unfortunate to have this right at the beginning to cut off the debate. And I just seem like the rationale for doing this is to get out of here faster and not to really entertain the spirit of, debate and the spirit of what is morally right. Yeah.
Thank you. Councillor Grehan? Yes.
So just to clarify, so if this went to policy, this motion went to policy, it would have to stay within relatively the same principles.
That's correct, yeah.
Okay.
It would require the same test, at least I would carry it with the same test as an amendment. So if there was a principle added that talked about, something completely different to this topic, then that wouldn't be germane. Yes.
If we pass the motion exactly as Councillor Muhammad has it written here,
yep.
Does it go to policy committee?
Yes, it goes to policy committee, who will draft the specific wording in advance of second reading.
Okay.
So to clarify the difference, if this motion to refer would send it to, we basically wouldn't vote on first reading at this moment, so it would send it to policy committee. Policy committee would make a recommendation on the principles, send the principles back to council, which then council is free to approve as is or amend. If that passes, then that would be the first reading vote, and then it would go to policy committee for a for development of the specific wording to come back to council for a second reading vote. Any other points of parliamentary inquiry at this point? Yeah?
Is it possible to table the motion to refer in order to have that later and go back to debate for the main motion?
Let me double check whether you can lay a subsidiary amendment on the table. So I want to make sure we do this properly.
Okay.
Yeah, so a motion to lay on the table can only be applied to a main motion, so we wouldn't be able to table the motion to refer. And sort of to clarify what would be sort of the alternative way of having the same effect, if this motion were to fail in the intent that someone were to bring it up later in the meeting, that's actually out of order, because you can't, just basically to stop people from trying to waste time, you can't bring forward the same motion again that has already failed, if that makes sense. Any other points of parliamentary inquiry at this point? Nope. Okay, Councillor Greenhead?
I'd like to speak against this motion to refer it to council.
Yeah, and debate right now should be restricted to the motion to refer.
Yeah. So. I think it would be extremely unfair to send these principles to wither and die in the bureaucracy and SU committees. I think that Councillor Mohammed has put an incredible amount of work into this, and I think it's personally disrespectful to him, and I think this is the appropriate place to have a debate. And I also think it's extremely personally disrespectful to all the students from the Muslim Students Association to come out to this meeting. And then, on a chance that we actually have student representation, from students, throw it away to the crappiness of SC committees. I think it's inappropriate. I think that based on the work that has been put into these principles, I think that they're sound and we should discuss them at this point. I would be really against referring this to the
Thank you. Councillor Bannister?
Although I am in favor of debate, I would like to speak in favor of this motion. To my immediate knowledge, this issue does not have a pressing time constraint against it. And I think in terms, if our overall objective is to better the students who are coming in from various paths, we do want to do this to the utmost highest regard. And I think that is by pushing it to policy committee to aid in this objective. I would hate to see something go through that hasn't been gone through the proper channels, and that be the reason why something in the future would say, oh, well, did it go through these channels? And I would hate for that to be a reason why any complications would occur, especially regarding this issue. So although I think debate is great, I think we had healthy debate in the last council meeting, and I see no immediate issue with pushing it to policy committee at this point.
Thank you. My shorthand writing is getting trickier. Councillor Nguyen, were you on the speaker's list? Okay. And again, reminder, if you want to call the question, it's just like a point of parliamentary inquiry where you can interrupt me and I won't get offended. Vice President Woods.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd like to speak in favor of this motion. I would like to speak to some of the comments that have been made earlier at this meeting. Certainly, SU committees might be slow at times, but there's a good reason for that. I've been involved with the SU now for a good number of years, and I'm not preaching some great ulterior experience. I'm just stating that I have found that anything this SU council has passed has taken a great deal of time and construction to work on and to put together. And honestly, I think this is something that deserves the merit of a policy, or deserves to be discussed at the policy committee. This is the first time in my experience that I've ever seen a policy go right past the committee and to council. And while that's a fine course of action, at times I feel that when we're dealing with an issue that is up in the air, it needs to be discussed by first of all a committee to do their best to make the policy more agreeable to the general council. That's why we do it, so that it doesn't come from one perspective and it's just trying to push through council. It comes from the perspective of everybody on that committee, where they can all have their own input to hopefully bring something to the council that will be passed. I think that by having this debate today, before a committee has had an ample opportunity to actually debate and discuss this before bringing it towards council and to make amendments and such, you're actually doing it a discredit. You're not helping it move forward. I feel that if you do want to give this policy an actual chance of being moved within the next year, then it should certainly go to the policy committee where a group of counselors can work on it for a good long period of time so that it's comfortable with everybody in the room if it ever reaches that point. So for that reason, I'd like to speak in favor of letting the policy committee do its job.
Thank you. Councillor Patel?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'll make this brief. I kind of refuse to accept the comments that were made. My intention of bringing this forward to the policy committee is because I'm extremely in favor of this motion and this policy, and I wanted to give everybody the opportunity to bring forward their comments and work on it as much as possible to make it feasible to pass and something that the university is not going to scrutinize us on and think that we are just passing it for no reason. So I think it takes a lot more research than what has been done. I've forwarded comments several times, and I have yet to get sufficient answers. So that's why I would like to come to the policy committee, and then we can definitely do our job in making it as best as it can possibly be.
Thank you. Councillor Redmond's next on my list, although, and I'm not sure I've done this up until this point, so in case you're curious why I'm doing this. Typically, I try and moderate debate in terms of going back and forth between in favor and opposed. We've had a couple people speak in favor. Councillor Redmond, which way are you speaking on? Okay, is there anyone that wishes to speak opposed to this motion? Councillor Mohammed, so you can go next.
Yeah, so there's three points I want to address. The first is that it's completely unnecessary to send it to the policy committee. If we do send it to policy, if we just pass the motion, it'll go to policy committee anyways. If we send it to policy committee, it'll just be added bureaucracy, and it will take an added, you know, few weeks, so it'll be up to July 30th before we get to put this on council. It's just unnecessary bureaucracy that we have to go through this, you know, ridiculous channels that are not even, like, the phrase uses proper channels. They're not proper channels. It's practice. It is not in the bylaw to follow this, you know, path. But, you know, besides that, like, people have mentioned that bringing the policy will make it a more presentable motion, will give it a more likely to pass. I'm just going to say that we shouldn't start a debate with the predisposition that a motion will fail. We should start a debate with an open mind so that we can have a discussion about the merits of the motion and eventually reach a conclusion. And if we do that with this, then we'll go back to policy anyways, and they can have their input in shaping the formal structure of the policy. And then also in terms of the time constraint, people have, you know, they're saying it's not an important thing to do. I think it is. Omar's parole hearing is coming up, if I'm correct. Yes, and if this is passed in council today, it'll look favorably in his parole hearing, and who knows, perhaps this will aid in him getting released from his unjust imprisonment. So this is crucial to get passed now. It'll give a moral boost to Omar, and it'll show his parole hearing that you know, students are willing to accept having him on campus. And I just also want to reiterate my extreme displeasure for this motion happening so early in the debate. I want to apologize to the individuals who stayed for the past 3 hours to listen to this debate because it's being cut short. I hope all the councillors vote no to this proposed motion so that we can have a debate, so that we can have an actual discussion where we don't start with the predisposition that this is going to fail. We'll start with an open mind, and I encourage councillors to have an open mind during this debate, if it continues.
Thank you. Councillor Redmond?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I just wanted to say that I think this illusion wasn't really engaged towards in a disrespectful way or to get rid of the way in like a way that it was going to fail right away. I think it's more that we want to get it through a way where it has ground, where like it's a closer, more open atmosphere. If you attended a policy committee meeting, it's not formal Robert's rule. You don't have to do all these things where it takes a really long time to get maybe one, two lines in there. If you put it through the policy committee in that the reading, you can bring the guests that came here tonight yourself, and you can listen and you can contribute things to that discussion, and you can add them in. It's much more clean. It's much quicker. I think it's a better way of going about writing an entire policy and making sure that it fits for the council to just pass as written. And also to talk about the points where if we just pass it through today versus if we just do this motion, I believe if we pass through today, it goes through the second reading. And if we put it to policy committee, it's in first reading still. It's in first reading, we can do amendments to the ideals in the ideas behind it a bit. If it's in second reading, I believe it's just grammar and just fixing up little things. So if we're just fixing up little things and we're missing parts of it, or we need to kind of edit things, I mean, I think that's important.
Yes, Councilor Mohammed. the part about when, whether, like the part that the first part about if this passes, it would be first reading, and if it doesn't, and council votes on it, would be second. That part was fully accurate. I'm not sure I would use quite the same phrasing in terms of simply grammatical changes that can be made. What I will say is that after a first reading, when a committee, either pilot policy committee or bylaw committee, is tasked with coming back to council, it is tasked with taking the principles that were approved and formulating them into the sort of specific phrasing, and I'll actually get the wording that it comes out on. So it actually, basically, the part for political policy says, like, ditto from the bylaw part, so I'm actually going to read off the bylaw part, because it doesn't actually read it in the first part, but it says, for second reading, debate is... it does include it in political policy. So it says, debate is confined to the technical merits of whether the committee properly interpreted the principles passed in first reading. So that's the best description. Councillor Hodgson? President Kuzmu?
Call to question?
It's a motion to call to question. Do we have a seconder for that motion? Vice President Woods, thank you. And again, this is calling to question on the motion to refer to the committee, not the main motion. Not debatable, not amendable, and requires two-thirds majority vote. All those in favor of calling to question? Hand up.
Call for division.
14. All those opposed? Just give me one sec. Actually, hang on one sec. Yeah, I'll take that. If I think it's a delay tactic, I don't have to take a call for division on a subsidiary motion, but I don't think it's a delay tactic, so we will call for division on this. President Kuzmu, again, you just, on this vote, you say in favor, opposed, or abstain. This is the vote. Oh, sorry, we're on the call to question, sorry. I was thinking we were on the motion to refer to the committee. So, sorry, call the question. Yeah, well, I'm not going to do a division on that one. So, all those in favor of calling to question, sorry. All those opposed? That motion carries. So, we are going to vote immediately on the motion to refer to the committee. All those in... and that requires just, I believe, a majority. This I will allow a call for division on. Yes, so just a majority vote. So, President Kuzmu.
And just to clarify, this is a motion so that we're saying this motion will be taken back to the policy committee to talk about it a little bit.
That's correct, yeah. And so if you're voting in favor of this motion, you're voting for that to happen. If you're voting opposed, then we would go back to debate within council. Yeah. So, President Kuzmu. Vice President Schelling.
In favor.
Vice President Woods.
In favor.
Vice President Lay.
In favor.
Vice President Lau.
In favor.
I don't believe Governor Kelly's still here. No. Councillor Battelle.
In favor.
Councillor Borden.
In favor.
Councillor Mills. Councillor Hanwell.
In favor.
Sorry, I should have noted on the record, Councillor Mills wasn't in favor. Was an in favor, so yes. Councillor Bannister.
In favor.
Councillor Schiavone. Councillor Mohammed.
Opposed.
Councillor Gruelke.
In favor.
Councillor Minarski.
In favor.
Councillor Valdez.
In favor.
Councillor Corbett. Councillor Redman.
In favor.
Councillor Hamid. Councillor Morris. Councillor Nguyen, Councillor Champagne is no longer here. Councillor Speakman?
Can I abstain?
Yes. Councillor Hodgson?
In favor.
Councillor Huang? Councillor Zhang?
Opposed.
Councillor Grehan?
Opposed.
Councillor Binchik? Councillor Douglas?
In favor.
So that motion carries 17 in favor, 3 opposed and 2 abstentions. So that will be referred to the Policy Committee, and we will expect to hear back from the Policy Committee in the near future on that. With that, we are at the end of our order paper, so I put favorably the bottom line to adjourn.
Motion to move forward, is that allowed?
Depending on what it is.
My understanding is Councillor Mohammed's not on Policy Committee. Am I able to motion to appoint him temporarily to Policy Committee? Suspend the relevant standing orders?
No, because it's actually not a standing order. It's in bylaw how many are on, who all is membership on there. What I would encourage instead is, I'm not sure if you're on policy or whom is, but there's a couple things I'll say with that. Number one, all members of council are welcome to attend, obviously not as voting members, but welcome to attend committee meetings, and so that's an option. You could also ask a member of policy committee to, if they would let you proxy if you were interested in being a voting member. Is this a point of parliamentary inquiry?
Yeah. So, since it's going to policy committee, I don't have any control in terms of the amendments. I can't vote on
You're not a voting member? No. So you're not able to vote on things at the policy committee level. You could obviously vote when it comes back to council at the council level. Any other clarifications on that? If not, then I would look favorably upon a motion to adjourn. Councillor Greenhand, do we have a seconder for that? Councillor Redman, all those in favour? Opposed? That motion is carried. We will take attendance for the last time. President Kuzmu.
Present.
President, Vice President Chellen.
Present.
Vice President Woods.
Present.
Vice President Blade.
Present.
Vice President Lau.
Present.
Governor Kelly. Vice President Vitale, or Councillor Vitale, excuse me. Give me Vice President. Councillor Borden.
Present.
Councillor Mills. Councillor Mills is here. Councillor Hanwell. Councillor Bannister.
Present.
Councillor Schiavone. Councillor Mohammed. Councillor Grupi.
Present.
Councillor Minarski. Councillor Valdez.
Present.
Councillor Corbett. Councillor Redman.
Present.
Councillor Hamid. Councillor Morris. Councillor Nguyen. Councillor Champagne. Councillor Speakman. Councillor Hodgson. Councillor Huang. Councillor Zhang. Folks, if I could just get through this, that'd be awesome. Councillor Grehan? Councillor Binchik? Councillor Douglas?
Yep.
All right, we are adjourned. We'll see you in 2 weeks. Yes. Thanks. Yep. Yeah, he just said something.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, I'm going to email you along the way.
Yeah.
Good.